Okay, welcome everyone to the Sutta class for today. We're going to be looking at the Satipatthana Sutta. Now, I hope you don't think this is going to be easy.
Definitely not.
Alright, that's good. Some teachers have the ability to take very, very complicated things and make them very, very simple. Others have the ability to take something very simple and make it very, very complicated. And I'm one of the latter. So this is my job here, is to make something which you thought was easy, difficult. And to take something you thought was simple, make it complicated. So just to give an initial impression of the degree of complication, of course, when we're talking about the Satipatthana Sutta, as you know, the whole basis of our teachings is predicated on the knowledge that, of course, it's not a the version of any of these suttas we're looking at all through the canon, that there's usually several versions, and no doubt the existing versions that we do have are only a small fragment of what may have existed once upon a time in ancient India. Now, with Satipatthana in particular, here we have a number of different versions. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. 7, just in case you thought we were missing one there. And so here's the 7 versions of the Satipatthana Sutta. Maybe there are others. Yeah, there's probably others lurking in places which we are not aware of. But so far, these are the only versions that I found of. There are a couple of Sanskrit fragments, but they are only just give some fragments of the basic Satipatthana sayings. So this is one of the problems, and this is one of the reasons why I actually, Venerable Metabha, can you pass me one of the books on that thing behind you? Thank you. So, one of the reasons why I got into researching the topic of Satipatthana was, of course, because I started to realize some of the problems with it. Now, of course, to start with, you know, we realize that it's very interesting to learn or to consider, like, what we know about these things, what we know about Buddhist meditation and Buddhist practices and so on. Of course, and how we know that, or what we think we know about it. Of course, when we come to meditate, most of us have gone along to a meditation center or something like that, and then they say, okay, they're going to teach us mindfulness. And then they'll explain to us that this is an ancient Indian meditative practice and so on and so forth. And many or most of the well-known Buddhist meditation traditions today are, of course, quite explicitly based on the Satipatthana Sutta. It's hardly an exaggeration to say that the entire movement of meditation in the 20th century, certainly within Theravada and to a large extent in the whole of the Buddhist world, remembering that others outside of Theravada, such as Thich Nhat Hanh and others, have also quite explicitly used the Satipatthana Sutta. So it's hardly an exaggeration to say that the whole movement of 20th century meditation, modernist meditation, was largely based on a reading of the Satipatthana Sutta. Okay? That's not so true of, say, the Thai forest tradition, where Satipatthana is not so central as it is in, of course, the Burmese traditions. But certainly in the Burmese traditions, it's basically the essence of what was like the rediscovery of meditation in our modern age. And we can find many, many sayings and statements by different authors. I've collected a few at the beginning of the book here, my book, History of Mindfulness. The Maurice Walsh, in his Introduction to the Long Discourses of the Buddha, the Digha Nikaya, said, Mahasatipatthana is generally regarded as the most important sutta in the entire Pali canon. While Pola Rahula, what the Buddha taught, of course many of us, including myself, is the first Buddhist book we read just about. The most important discourse ever given by the Buddha on mental development meditation is called the Satipatthana Sutta. Bhikkhunyana Tiloka is the great founder of the Western scholastic tradition in Sri Lanka. He said, Satipatthana Sutta is by all Buddhists rightly considered the most important part of the whole Sutta Pitaka and the quintessence of the whole meditation practice, and so on and so forth. And we even find that it's not only been given this kind of sense of centrality and importance by modern meditation schools, but also in traditional practice, especially in Sri Lanka. And so there's a very interesting passage in Venerable Ponika's The Heart of Buddhist Meditation. He says, in Lanka, for instance, the island of Ceylon, where on full moon days lay devotees observe 8 of the 10 principal precepts of novice monks staying for the day and the night in the monastery, they frequently choose this sutta to read, recite, listen to, and contemplate. Okay? Interesting that they read it, recite it, listen to it, and contemplate it, but there's no mention that they actually meditate according to it. Still, in many a home, the Satipatthana book is reverently wrapped in a clean cloth, and from time to time in the evening it is read to members of the family. Often this discourse is recited on the bedstead of a dying Buddhist, so that in the last hour of his life his heart may be set on, consoled, and gladdened by the Master's great message of liberation. Though ours is an age of print, it is still customary in Ceylon to have new palm leaf manuscripts of this sutta written by scribes and to offer them to the library of a monastery. A collection of nearly 200 such manuscripts of the Satipatthana Sutta, some with costly covers, was seen by the writer in an old monastery of Ceylon. So, in saying this and in writing this, you know, you see the perspective people are coming from. Jnanaponika, who is one of the major presenters of Theravada tradition to the West, the Bhikkhu Bodhi's teacher, of course, he's extolling these traditional practices and traditional centrality of the Satipatthana Sutta. And it's easy to overlook the fact that there is actually no mention of actually meditation in that passage. Okay, so what we're talking about here is precisely is the fetishization of a physical object on which the sacred scriptures are written. Okay, you get the sacred object, you wrap it up into a cloth, you put it onto a shrine, you read through it. And he also neglects to say, of course, when they're reading through it in Pali, which nobody can understand. Okay, so it's become an object of worship. Okay, and this sutta, this is how the sutta has developed. This is where that attitude of reverence to the sutta comes from. Now, why is this so? What's actually going? What is the importance of it? Why has it been given such centrality? There are a number of reasons why that may be so. It's also interesting to note that in modern times, in say recent years, Rupert Gethin is one of the best of the modern Buddhist scholars. Wrote an article about the meaning of Dhamma. Of course, Dhamma, very central term in Buddhism. Okay, what does Dhamma mean? Okay, and to argue his case on this, Rupert Gethin based his argument very largely on the Pali version of the Satipatthana Sutta, which has a long section on contemplation of dhammas. And so he said, well, we can see what dhammas means because of how it's treated here in this section in the Satipatthana Sutta. And so he was, using his modern scholarly approach, again, based on solely on the Pali version of the Satipatthana Sutta, to reach very far-reaching conclusions about the nature of dhammas in early Buddhism. Now, those conclusions that he reached were that, in brief, that there was no substantial difference in the nature of dhammas between the suttas and the early Abhidhamma. Okay, and so this, of course, another controversial issue in Buddhism: is there any difference in doctrine between the suttas and the Abhidhamma? Now, by reaching this conclusion, Gethin was trying to bridge the gap which many people feel that exists between the suttas and the Abhidhamma by pointing out some similarities, okay? And I, of course, wrote an article critiquing his findings, of course, and sent it to him. And the problem is that, from my point of view, it's actually the other way around. It's not that the teaching of Dhammas in the Satipatthana Sutta somehow anticipates the Abhidhamma treatment, but rather the other way around, that the teachings in the Satipatthana Sutta are an early form of Abhidhamma teachings. Okay, that is to say that the teachings we find, especially in the Pali version of the Satipatthana Sutta, were compiled long after the Buddha's lifetime and should be representative of the Abhidhamma phase of Buddhist doctrinal development rather than the Sutta phase. So this is a very radical conclusion. So how can it be that everybody else regards this without any question as being, you know, literally the words of the Buddha, and yet we can reach such far-reaching conclusions to say that actually Satipatthana Sutta wasn't really the words of the Buddha, and that it's in important ways has been subject to change over time. Okay, so how can we hope to sustain such a bold thesis? Okay, and so many people are quite outraged by this. They think, how can you possibly say it's a fake? So this is what I said in my book. I called it the Piltdown Sutta. I don't think many people kind of got the joke, but if you know the great controversy about the Piltdown man was like a monkey with a human skull dressed up to be the missing link, and from a place called Piltdown, and so they called it the Piltdown man. So anyway, so I called the sutta the Piltdown Sutta.
Can I ask you a question first, I wait?
No, no, go on.
In terms of when you talk about the Sadhikatana Sutta and does it much later, in that are you including the, are you making a distinction between the general, the importance of mindfulness practice and sati that the Buddha stresses in the Samyutta and the Kaya and in all the other practices?
Yeah.
Are you making a distinction between those teachings and the sutta, or are you including all teachings on mindfulness?
No, the first part. So I'm talking specifically about the redaction of this text,
okay.
Not the Buddhist teachings on mindfulness in general.
Okay.
And so what this text does, like so many of the other texts we've looked at, is it takes those things, all of the bits of which may well be authentic, and then puts them in a particular organization. It orders them and so on. The issue here is not so much that there's anything wrong with any of the bits. The problem is that the way that they're organized gives a certain impression, okay, about the nature of Satipatthana. And it's from that impression that many of the conclusions and ideas about what Satipatthana are taken, okay? Yeah, we'll talk more about that as it goes on, yeah. So for those who are outraged at the suggestion that the Satipatthana could have been subject to editorial schmiggle-schmoggles, as the technical term goes. Here we have the title, this is the Majjhima Nikaya, Majjhima 10, Maha Satipatthana Sutta. Now, of course, anybody who knew the Pali Canon would immediately recognize that the Maha Satipatthana Sutta actually belongs in the Digha Nikaya and not in the Majjhima Nikaya. There are two versions of the sutta in Pali. A Digha version, appropriately called the Maha, the Great Satipatthana Sutta, contains an extra long section on the Four Noble Truths. And I think we find this section here, all on the Four Noble Truths, and here it goes into details about... So this section here, I'll just scroll through the section from the beginning. From here, on the Four Noble Truths, what is the fourth? Birth is truth, birth is suffering, aging is suffering, and so on. So it goes from here down to, and this is heavily abbreviated, I should add, from here down to here is all added in to the Maha Satipatthana Sutta. Okay, it doesn't belong in the Satipatthana Sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya, and it's all an interpolation. So we've obviously got two versions anyway, and it's fairly obvious that the Digha Nikaya version is just the Majjhima Nikaya version with the section on the Four Noble Truths stuck in from the Satchavibhanga Sutta. But that very large chunk of textual material is now being moved into the Majjhima Nikaya. There's no parallel to this whatsoever. There's no other case, as far as I'm aware, in the Pali Canon where a very large chunk, many pages of textual material has been moved from one place to another within recent memory. The first evidence I have for this is in the Pali Text Society edition, which is dated 1880, okay, which notes this, so it presumably must date from the 1800s, perhaps what they call the Fifth Council in Burma. And why was the textual material moved? Well, in the absence of any other explanation, I can only presume that it was moved because it supported the ideology of the people who were redacting the canon, and because they wanted to teach Vipassana Satipatthana, so they decided to re-edit the suttas to give the impression that their sutta was more important than may have been. So this has happened in recent times, okay? And this is a peculiarity of the Burmese tradition. It's not found in the Thai or the Sri Lankan editions. Unfortunately, it's the case that this digital version, as most of the digital versions that are around, are based on the Burmese edition of the canon, and so they all have this in it. So we're kind of losing sight of how outrageous this kind of thing is. So we can't, what this shows us is that we certainly can't say that there's been no messing around. Obviously there has been, right? We obviously got two different versions, and there's been messing around in recent times, okay? So, and it also seems quite likely that the messing around is ideologically motivated in this case. It's not simply as we've seen many, many times throughout the suttas, that things will be different from one version to another, and there doesn't seem to be any particular agenda behind that. It's just the natural variations in the tradition, whereas in this case it seems like there's something more to it than that. So it has been a text which has been used in recent times from a very polemical point of view, and in my opinion that current polemicization of the text also stems back quite a long way into history. Okay?
So what you're saying is that the Thai and versions of the Sutta Pitaka are different to the one in the Burmese.
Right.
Correct?
Yeah.
They have the original which Bhikkhu Bodhi keeps in his...
Bhikkhu Bodhi's got his translation, yeah.
And it doesn't have the Four Noble Truths section.
Yeah, it's just got a short section on the Four Noble Truths, just the summary of it, but without the full analysis.
So the section which has been added in there, is that word for word?
More or less, yeah. It's actually, there actually seems to have been a little bit more to it than that. It's certainly the same passage, but it seems to have been, it's also identical with the passage on the Four Noble Truths in the Vibhanga of the Abhidhamma, and in certain respects seems to have even been influenced by the Abhidhamma text rather than the Majjhima Nikaya text. For example, you have this one here, Jivitindriyasu Pachedo. This is a standard list of this is a definition of death. And what is death? The falling away of beings from this or that class of beings, the dying, death, breaking up, a disappearance, death, all different synonyms for death, Machu, Maranang, Kalang, Kiriya, making of the time, breaking up of the khandhas, the laying down of the carcass. And then this word here, Jivitindriyasu Pachedo, is a particularly Abhidhamma term, not normally found in the suttas, the cutting off of the life faculty. Okay, so the Jivitindriya being a kind of an Abhidhammic style term. So in this case, there's a few little words that seem to have crept back into the suttas from the Abhidhamma usage. Okay, but in almost all cases, it's just taken straight from the Satchavibhanga Sutta.
And you complained to the Burmese about this one?
I did complain to them, yes. And
got no response.
I got no response. So I've been trying to get the Theravadins outraged about this for a long time. No one seems to want to do anything about it. Anyway, so what's going on here? Why this particular text? Why is it so important? And why so many different takes on it? You're always a bit suspicious when you see this particular text. It collects a whole disparate group of meditation techniques and assembles them together. Like normally when we looked at the suttas, they'll teach perhaps one particular meditation technique or another. They might teach, the four elements, or they might teach breath meditation or something like that. This one gets a whole lot of them and puts them together. So it's starting to look like a meditation manual. It's starting to, rather than being an instruction to a particular person at a particular time and saying this is how you meditate, it's starting to look like a compilation of all the teachings on meditation, okay, which can be used as almost like a curriculum on meditation. It's tending in that direction. There's other suttas that also tend in that direction, but it's what it's starting to look like. So perhaps this bit was used in the early schools for that purpose. And so as the communities were starting to separate and starting to define themselves, each school would put into their own version of the Saripatthana Sutta the particular meditation techniques and approaches which may have been emphasized by the teachers in that local region. Okay, and so it sort of developed different emphasis for those kind of reasons. This is one possible theory for why we've ended up with the different versions.
So it's a bit like the proto-Vasudhimagga.
Exactly, yeah, like the first attempt at something like that. So you could even trace the lineage from the Satipatthana Sutta to the Patisamhita Magga, to the Vimutti Magga, and then to the Visuddhi Magga as being like the compilations of the sutta. So you can see here, just to get some basic kind of a spectrum on it, just a basic overview, you can see that certain things are more similar and certain things are more different. Okay, so this is the contemplation of the body section here. And so you can see that some versions, we have quite a few different things in the contemplation of the body, which differ between each other. In other versions, we only find a small number of items under the contemplation of the body. Okay. In contrast, in the contemplation of feelings and the contemplation of the mind, they tend to be more similar. There are some differences, but they're much more in common, much more similar. And the contemplation of dhammas is about half and half. It's some things similar and some things different. So there's like a spectrum of particular teachings and so on, which may be included in there. And of course, there's no reason to think that the original Satipatthana Sutta was in any way meant to be kind of a definitive and final list of all the things that were Satipatthana. Okay, so maybe they were just teaching a particular thing at a particular time, and gradually more and more things got put in there. So when we go through it, we'll go through and have a look at the different parts or aspects of the sutta and the terminology that's used, and some of the differences between them and what they might mean. Okay, so any questions on that so far? The next bit.
Can you ask where the seven different versions come from, which schools?
Okay, can I go into that in a little minute? Okay, before I go on to talking about the sutta, I'll just talk a little bit about the background. I mean, I already mentioned that there are many other suttas on mindfulness and Satipatthana in the canons. And so then that invites us to consider what's the relationship between this sutta and the other suttas, okay? There's about 72 suttas on Satipatthana collected in the Satipatthana Sangyutta. So that immediately invites the question, why is it that this one sutta is given such tremendous importance and the other 72 suttas are almost ignored? Okay, that's quite an interesting question. Why is this one sutta presented in this way? So when I started to think about these kinds of things, I started to consider more deeply what the question of, like, the relationship between different parts of the Pali canon and the Buddhist scriptures in general, and what kinds of meaning there is from the connections and so on between the different parts. What I'm trying to get an idea of is the question that we need to try to answer is, like, what is the actual connection between what we're trying to practice and the text which that practice is supposed to be based on? And this is something which we normally don't really reflect on very deeply. We're told, oh yes, this is the Satipatthana practice, this is what the Buddha taught, so on, so on, so forth. And we take it on faith. Because, you know, we're told, oh, you don't take anything on faith, you know, but of course we all do. And Buddhists are very bad at this. They go around saying how Buddhism, you don't take things on faith and it's a way of inquiry and so on and so forth, but they never actually do any. They just accept what they're told, and if you question it, then you'll get condemned as a heretic. But what actually is, how do you describe meditation? Like, I'm a meditation teacher. I have people come to me all the time and say, how do you meditate? And you say, you do this, do this, do this. And you talk to them a week later, and of course they haven't done what you've said at all. They've gone off and done something completely different, okay? How is it possible to communicate inward states of mind and approaches to development of mind? Yeah, how is it possible to communicate this? This is what the question which the Buddha was trying to address, and which the suttas have answered, I think, with a degree of clarity and precision, which was unprecedented in previous literature. But still, you can't really surmount that huge gap between what there is, what we're feeling inside, and what we see when we read a text. And so, of course, people can read the same text and come away with very, very different kinds of ideas about what they're supposed to be doing in meditation. And we are also, we have to admit that in doing so, we're at the mercy of the decisions made by redactors. Okay, we have this faith that this is a sutta, it's the teachings of the Buddha, but of course it's passed through many, many hands in between the Buddha and us. Okay. What's happened to this in the meantime? Yeah? What has happened? You know, we know anybody who's ever been, this is one of the things I learned as a musician, that if you ever do an interview with a journalist, like the connection between what you actually say during the interview and what appears in the newspaper is extremely tenuous, yeah? And it's the norm. It's not unusual or whatever. It's very normal that the things that are said, you think, oh, I hadn't said that, you know? But so how can we trust this process which has come down for such a long period of time? And so we start to want to examine the ways in which our own meditation practice may actually be determined not by what the Buddha taught about meditation, but determined by questions of textual redaction, questions of how do we organize an oral literature. Okay? So in organizing an oral literature, the form is shaped in a way which is going to affect how we read the content. Okay. And so this is why, you know, I think, you know, we invest so much effort into our meditation practice, okay, on faith. We go to these retreats and we sit there for hour after hour after hour after hour, an incredible amount of effort into that, without actually thinking to investigate, well, what's the basis? Why am I doing this? What's the basis for it? What is this actually founded upon?
No, it's one of the reasons that hasn't happened so much, and that is because the actual practice of mindfulness does bring results. I mean, that it's directed enough, it's seated in the context of what the Buddha is talking about when he says the impermanent anicca in the Satipatthana Sutta and a lot of other places, that non-self unsatisfactoriness, that through mindfulness practice in the different not foundations but that it actually does work that way, and that's why it hasn't been challenged in the ways that you're challenging.
Yeah, I think I don't have any 100% answers on that. I think certainly that's a large part of it, you know. And there's no doubt that much of what is taught under the name of Satipatthana is perfectly good, you know, and is found in the suttas, and it does work, you know, and there's no doubt about that. So what I'm more concerned about is the specific, some of the specific ideas with which that practice is wrapped up in, which can sometimes determine or affect the actual practice itself, sometimes not. Yeah.
See, that because it feels like what? Because I feel like as a teacher of mindfulness, I'm hearing you speak at least on the scholarship level, which sounds, you know, like totally legitimate. Then on this other level, I'm like, the question that comes up for me is, well, it does work. It is freeing, so why such a big thing about it?
Okay, well, just to give an example, okay? So this is a kind of concrete example, which I think is not uncommon. I've seen quite a few people with... Okay, so a very practical example. At the beginning of the Satipatthana Sutra, it says, Ekayana Ayang Bhikkhave Maggo. This is the Ekayana path, okay? We talked a little bit about this the last couple of weeks. I think Ekayana path means the way to unification. Okay, it's building a whole heart, basically. But the tradition doesn't interpret it in that way at all. The tradition says
Nibbana direct path.
Yes, I had the thing here. Where is it?
Bhikkhu has changed his translation of that.
To what?
He calls it
direct path.
He calls it the this is the one way path.
The one way path, yeah. So, what is a one-way path? Here, it's a path which one goes oneself.
Yeah.
Okay, therefore, it's called the one-way path. It's the one path, the ekamago, and so on. So, there's different explanations for that. Now, that changes drastically the emphasis of how you use your attention in meditation. Okay, because the emphasis on unification as part of Satipatthana is almost completely gone. And so what you find, and what I certainly find practically as a meditation teacher, is a lot of people fragment their consciousness by using these meditation techniques. Okay? They're meditation techniques which are based on the idea of vipassana, which is based on the idea of cutting things up, analyzing them, and watching them disintegrate. And so by doing these vipassana techniques, a lot of people, not everybody, fragment their minds to one degree or another, okay? Through, say, you know, just through this whole thing of directing attention to whatever miscellaneous phenomena arises. So you haven't got a center of attention, you keep on shifting attention around, yeah? to all different places. And so this is one aspect which is, I think, very practical and which causes a lot of problems. I mean, I could give many examples. Yeah.
Maybe you could give one?
Give one, come on,
please. Well, I mean, what can I say? Okay, I'll give you an example. When I was at the chanting ceremony in Bodhgaya last year, and there was one of the Thai lay women who was a very lovely upasika, one of these kind of dressed up in white and very looking after the monks and very polite and so on. And I was talking to her, and she was asking for some advice, and she was saying how she'd basically given up her life and given up her work and so on. She's a professional from Bangkok and gone and stayed in Burma and doing the Vipassana practice there. And she just had a lot of problems and a lot of obstacles, and her back had been really bad and her health had been really bad and so on and so forth. And so I was kind of trying to sympathize with her and said to her, well, you know, maybe your body's sick, but at least your mind's healthy. And then she said, well, actually, no, I don't think so. So we're going, oh, God, here goes another one. And she's just sort of, you know, just saying she can't sleep at night and her mind's just completely all over the place and so on and so forth, yeah? And these are practices which have, the things which have come about, you know, subsequent to doing the Vipassana practice. So these are, you know, this is kind of typical of the kinds of problems which you hear about.
Can I just say one more thing on relationship to the, but experientially, which it feels like that mindfulness actually does unify, that it doesn't fragment, that the effect of knowing and contemplating actually brings experience into a relationship, and so it's just the opposite. That for me, what when I think about it not being unified, it's because the mind focuses too much onto those arising different experiences. So it's that you're not actually practicing mindfulness correctly if that happens, because the mind is not held in the knowing and the understanding of what the experience is, which is unifying.
Yeah, so you're going too much out to the object rather than, yeah. But that's exactly how they teach it. And if you go to many of these Burmese schools, that's precisely what they teach you to do, is to go out to the object all the time.
Yes. I mean, there's more of an emphasis on, on striking the object with mindfulness.
Exactly, yeah. Right. So in a sense, you know, what you're saying to me sounds like a kind of a modified approach to that practice, which actually comes from an acknowledgement that it has gone too far in that direction. And so probably, you know, from what you're saying, maybe yourself and other teachers have found that and actually teach more of a subjective orientated practice, okay, precisely as a result of these problems emerging.
Well, I think we're teaching from what it means to say clear knowing from the Satipatthana Sutta, that it's like that clear knowing of what your experience is as well as it's the understanding that sati is not like concentration in that it holds the understanding in the environment that it's presenting.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, I think that's what the Satipatthana Sutta is saying. And, you know, you can shut me up for a second. It just feels like this is so important.
Yeah. No, it's good. Yeah, well, certainly, I think that that difference, yeah.
It's like taking both those together, Satipatthana and Satipatthana.
Yeah. I think that difference that we're talking about, those different approaches, can actually be seen in a embryonic form within the Satipatthana Sutta itself, okay? And the way that it's been treated and the way that it's been analyzed, okay? And so we'll talk about a few examples about that. So a move from mindfulness as a subjective towards an objective sense, okay? And we'll talk a bit more about that later on.
The fundamental problem that people have with the meditation, I think a lot of that is because they, like in Burma, they teach, like Mahasi, just you have to adhere strictly to the form.
That's part of it? Many things contribute, and they contribute in strange ways. I mean, one thing, obviously, at the end you've got this thing saying, you know, if you practice even for 7 days, then you can get enlightened, you know. And I think this is where the whole modern idea of the meditation retreat comes from, right? It's taken from a reification of this passage, which basically the Buddha's just trying to say, you know, this is effective and go out and do it, and if you practice diligently, you'll get the results. But then it becomes sort of reified into this thing of, oh, you do these kind of 7-day intensive meditation retreats, and I think that's where it comes from. Yeah. And so in many ways, things have been taken quite literally from the text. And at the very least, I think it's useful that we should be aware of this and be able to reflect upon it.
Let's not also forget that Mahasamy apparently used to give out certificates of what level of attainment you've attained as well, like a stream entry certificate or something like that.
Yeah. Okay. Now, so just to come back to the textuality of the whole thing. So this talk, you know, for today, we're trying to focus mainly on the text, okay? And the practical questions, the applications, the interpretation, you know, it's important to be aware of the context, but it's also important not to be over-determined by those things. If we give too much weight to the interpretation of it beforehand, then we blinkered from actually trying to read the text. So we try to forget as much as we can everything we've learned about Satipatthana. This is one of the big problems. And rather than assuming we know anything at all about what mindfulness is or sati is and so on, we just try to see what the text is actually saying. This is the process that I went through in writing History of Mindfulness. I was just trying to continually deconstruct my own ideas about these things and to subject them to a historical and textual critique, so that we could always come back and try to say, well, what's the actual grounding for these ideas? Okay, so a number of things. So I mentioned before the relationship between the Satipatthana Sutta. So notice how we say the Satipatthana Sutta, right? One of 70 or 80 Satipatthana Suttas, okay? What's the relationship between that sutta and the other suttas on Satipatthana, okay? Now, so when we look at the early canon, say in the Pali, as an example, what we often find is that, say with the case of Satipatthana, you have the Satipatthana Sanyutta. So in the Sanyutta Nikaya, along with other major topics like the khandhas and the sense bases and the dependent origination and so on, you've got a collection of suttas all grouped together according to topic on the four Satipatthanas. Okay, so that's fine. Then elsewhere in the canon, you also have occasional suttas dealing with Satipatthana or teachings on Satipatthana embedded within other suttas. And then you ask the question, why is it that you've got, you know, these 70 suttas were gathered together and then these other ones were kind of left out? Was that just an oversight or whatever? What you tend to notice when you do this, and certainly is the case in Satipatthana, is that if you look at especially the four main Nikayas, and also to some extent the fifth Nikaya, and also to some extent the Vinaya and Abhidhamma, but mainly the four main Nikayas, is that the important teachings tend to be distributed across each Nikaya. Okay? So you've got, you know, if you've got the Digha, Majjhima, Sanyutta, Anguttara, the main teachings on Satipatthana are in here, but some are also found in the Digha Nikaya, some are also found in the Majjhima Nikaya, some are also found in the Anguttara Nikaya. And that's a fairly consistent pattern that we find with the different teachings. And so the purpose of that seems to have been that for recitation, that the canon was split into four groups, plus the fifth Nikaya is another group, and the Vinaya and so on is another, but with this, the four main Nikayas, it would tend to be different groups of monks and nuns who were reciting these things. So they would specialize in the Digha or they would specialize in the Majjhima and so on. And so because of that, you want to ensure that each collection has a reasonably full and balanced curriculum. Okay? So that you know, those people who are reciting the Digha should have a teaching on dependent origination, they should have a teaching on the Four Noble Truths, they should have a teaching on so on and so forth. And should have a teaching on Satipatthana, because they didn't necessarily know what was in the Majjhima. Okay, it wasn't that they were completely unaware of it, but the degree of knowledge of what the Majjhima people were doing or the Sanyuttas were doing. Of course, there'd be a few experts who would know, you know, what was going on in all of them, but the majority of monks and nuns would tend to specialize in one or the other. And so this explains, for example, the relationship between the Satipatthana Sutta and the Maha Satipatthana Sutta. Okay, so you've got the Satipatthana Sutta, teaching about Satipatthana in detail, with the Four Noble Truths in brief. Now, that teaching on the Four Noble Truths is then found in detail elsewhere in the Majjhima Nikaya, in the Satchavibhanga Sutta. So those teachings are there. They're not in that sutta, but they're in the same collection. Now then, if you take that Satipatthana Sutta and put it in the Digha Nikaya, there's nowhere else in the Digha Nikaya where those teachings on the Four Noble Truths are found in detail. Okay? So, very sensible decision on the part of the redactors is you take the teachings on the Four Noble Truths from the Majjhima and you put them into the Mahasatipatthana Sutta. Okay? And so this is the agenda driving that would seem to be to create a full and balanced curriculum for the reciters of the Digha Nikaya, okay? Which is all very sensible. Yeah, there's no particular problem there. Of course, it doesn't mean that sutta was actually literally spoken by the Buddha, but it means that it's quite a sensible way to arrange your textual material. Now, of course, we found that it's moved back from the Digha Nikaya back into the Majjhima, where, of course, it doesn't form that function anymore. Okay, so what you see is that the functions and the agendas which are shaping the texts have a particular contextual relevance, okay? And that form, that structure that they're in, will continue to exert an influence after that relevance has dissipated. It doesn't apply anymore. These days it doesn't matter. We pick up the Digha, we pick up the Majjhima, we have all of them. So the reason why those editorial decisions were made doesn't apply anymore, and yet we still inherit the texts, okay? So these are some of the ways in which our experience of the text these days is shaped by the decisions of the redactors. Now, again, why, to come back to that question I keep raising, why are these suttas not found in the Satipatthana Samyutta? Or what's the relationship between these things? So this started to get me into investigating the connections between the different parts of the Pali canon. Okay? Now, what I noticed was a number of things. One thing was that if you look at other teachings on Satipatthana, apart from, if you leave aside the Satipatthana Sutta and look at other teachings on Satipatthana, you tend to find that they focus more on samatha, on samadhi practice, on unification of mind. And whereas the Satipatthana Sutta, focuses more on the vipassana, okay, impermanence and these kinds of things. And so this is something I noticed is a shift in emphasis. And so this calls into question this basic equation of modern, which is like a fundamental equation of modern meditation techniques, is Satipatthana means vipassana. They're essentially synonyms. And, you know, you find books on, they call Satipatthana vipassana meditation. Of course, Satipatthana is never called vipassana. The word vipassana is never used in relationship to Satipatthana anywhere in the suttas.
Okay. Ananya talks about, and I followed them up, several discourses relating the practice of Satipatthana to direct realization. In the Samyutaya Book 5, 158, 181, 182, and 363.
Mm-hmm.
So when you say that the practice talks about unification, in these quotes it's about sati, not about jhana.
Well, again, what's the relationship between sati and jhana?
Well, at least for stream entry, until stream entry, it's that you don't need the four jhanas.
And where's that from?
Ananya quotes the different suttas that I followed up in the Samyutta that said that talked about stream entry without saying that you needed jhana.
Yeah. Okay, well, yeah, I don't want to get diverted too much into these kinds of things.
Okay.
We talked about this just the other week, okay, in talking about sati in the Chulavedala Sutta. The basic function of sati in the suttas is to bring about jhanas. Okay? This is the basic function of mindfulness. And this kind of oppositional approach that sees sati as something separate from jhana is entirely based on the kind of the Mahasi kind of dogmas. it doesn't have any foundation in the suttas. Kinds of passages which Anala is quoting there are merely things that say that, you know, you practice satipatthana and then it helps you to get enlightened, basically, is what it's saying. It's really got nothing to do with the issues that we're talking about here, because the same thing is told about everything. Okay, and if you want to follow up suttas, there's suttas on every kind of way of practice, which will say, if you do this,
you can have four jhanas themselves.
The four jhanas, many, many times it says, if four jhanas helps you get enlightened, or even the suttas we've been reading, it says, you know, good friendship helps you get enlightened, or anything like that. Those kinds of things are found again and again and again in suttas. All that they mean is that these things are good things which you should do, which are part of the path, and if you do them properly and do them together, they'll help you to get enlightened. So that's got nothing to do with the issue of whether satipatthana itself is primarily a practice of samatha or vipassana. Okay, if you understand that, then you have to understand more precisely what's meant by samatha and vipassana. Okay, so samatha is again discussed in the first part of the book. My book is that samatha is essentially peace of mind. Okay, and vipassana is, again, you have to distinguish. Vipassana is not realization, okay? And that's a very, very important distinction. Vipassana has got nothing to do with realization as such, okay? In the sense that we're talking about here. Vipassana is a practice of contemplation of impermanence, okay? Anicca, dukkha, anatta, one's contemplating these things. The result of vipassana, together with samatha, in the context of the path as a whole, is realization, okay? But if you just simply say sati leads to realization, doesn't mean you dispense with all the other aspects of the path. It just means that's what the Buddha was pointing out at that particular point in time. Yeah? So this is why these questions of that I'm raising about the relationship between different aspects of the texts are very important, precisely to avoid this kind of problem of reifying one particular context, taking it, one particular passage, take it out of context and say, well, here it's saying this. And so the two principles which are very important, and which I'll mention here, which is intertextuality and intratextuality. Okay, intertextuality means they're basically horizontal and vertical principles of textual relationships. So intertextuality means that in something like the suttas, that any one text will relate to many different other texts. It's part of a whole kind of web of meaning, okay? And you can't tell the full meaning of a particular passage just from one context. Now, in some places that's very obvious. It's very obvious when you're given specific definitions of things, okay? So it says, you know, right samadhi, and then in another passage it says right samadhi means the four jhanas or something like that. And so there you've got a very obvious intertextual relationship, and many times it's much more subtle than that. You also have the relationship of intratextuality, which is where textual units, which may be as small as a word or even as a part of a word, have some kind of lastingness in time. Okay, so you find the same kinds of things tend to reappear again and again and again through time. Okay, so this is a phenomenon they call intratextuality. Okay, we're very familiar with those kinds of things in English. If you've ever looked at the English language, you realize that there's so many idioms. You know, like you have an idiom like a thorn in my side. You know, someone's a thorn in my side. Well, actually, that's a quote from the King James edition of the Bible. Okay, so we're constantly reusing phrases, and so these phrases and passages and so on have a life which goes beyond the text of itself. Now, that's both of these two things are very, very important. And the fascinating thing for me is how these things actually, that texts as a product of the mind in this way actually reflect how the mind is. And so this is how the mind is. The mind actually has these webs of relationships on one level. Okay, so we can see all those relationships happening in the mind at one time. But also the mind sustains itself over time and over a long period of time. Okay, and again, the interesting thing in this particular passage is that in this particular context, is that factor which sustains things over time is precisely mindfulness. Okay? So sati is precisely that which sustains textual knowledge over time. Okay? And that's the root meaning of the word in the Indic context. Sati is that factor of the mind which enables us to remember a text over time. Okay? And when we look at the root meaning of sati in the Sanskrit form smriti, that's what it means. Smriti in the Brahmanical tradition means the remembered texts. Okay, so that's what it is. It doesn't mean, it's got nothing to do with meditation as such. And when we look at how the process of how that's described in the Brahmanical scriptures, you know, it talks about how do you actually do it, right? It's something most of us are out of touch with. I mean, we still in the Sangha, we still keep alive a tradition of oral textuality. We remember texts, remember the Parimokkha and so on. We learn texts like the Mahasatipatthana Sutta. Okay, so I learned this text when I was a novice. Okay, it takes 3 or 4 hours to recite, and you get a much more kind of intimate relationship with a text, but you realize that the text has like a symbiotic relationship, a mutual relationship with your mind, okay? In the sense that if your mind is not working, right? As the Buddha said a Brahmin came to the Buddha and said, sometimes the mantras are clear to me, sometimes they're not. And why is that? And the Buddha said, well, because when you have the five hindrances there, then the mantras are not clear to you. When the five hindrances are absent, then the mantras are clear. So in that case, the clarity of the mind helps you to remember the text, but also the other also applies in that remembering and reciting the text also helps you to build your concentration and clarity of mind. So the two things work together. And so it describes these things in the Brahmanical scriptures. How do you remember the Vedas? Remember this incredible feat of memory that the Brahmins did. The Vedas dating from 1200 BC, the individual verses in it dating from much earlier than that. And they were passed down with the very dialectical accents and metrical forms and things preserved intact over at least 2,000 years, if not more, okay, in an oral tradition. And so it describes this process where, you know, to practice them every day. It says one of the phrases, it says non-recitation is the rust of the mantras, okay? And so it says every day you have to go out and leave, you know, your family and leave your home behind. You go out into the forest. You've got to find a quiet place, sit down in the forest, you know, do your puja or your ritual or something, and then you sit down and you focus on the chant and you recite the chant and so on to yourself. And so you can see this is obviously in some way a precursor of what we know of as meditation practice, yeah? That to be able to do this, you need that clarity, you need that dedication, you need the space. And of course it would be a very joyous experience for people doing that, you know? You know, this is, by for them, by reciting the mantras, they were actually not just, you know, getting through their lessons, right? Reciting the mantras was actually physically participating in the fabric of the universe. Yeah, the first thing that Brahma uttered was the Vedas. Yeah, and they are literally keeping the sun coming up. Yeah, they're literally making the seasons. They're participating in this whole fabric of life by reciting those verses. And if all the Brahmins stopped, the universe would collapse. Okay, so this is the way that they saw this thing. And so the incredible joy and faith there would be to do that. And so bring up those very wholesome qualities of mind. And of course, if you've done oral recitation and chanting for long periods of time, and you know, if you do it with mindfulness and with care and a sense of joy in the mind, it can make the mind very, very bright, yeah? And you can develop some quite good states of samadhi doing so. So this is one of the roots of where meditation in general comes from, and Satipatthana in particular comes from, okay? So when we start to look at it like that, we start to realize that there is, it's not just something which is kind of floating around at random, but there is an actual definite historical context to the practice of Satipatthana. Now that historical context is not merely an inference, okay? It's not merely something which you can draw out of the etymology of the words, but is actually specifically emphasized in the suttas themselves. And I mentioned previously about the use of ekayana and how in the Sanyutta, when it uses this word ekayano ayambikue maggo, it's actually putting this phrase into the voice of Brahma. I think it mentions it up here a little bit in the commentary. I'm not sure where that is now. So it's actually Brahma who comes down and says, this is the one-way path, okay? Or this is the Ekayana Magga, okay? This is Sasana Visuddhi here. Just trying to see if the verses are here. Not only do the Buddhist texts say this phrase comes from the voice of Brahma, but also the Brahmanical scriptures themselves also use these similar words. So the word Ekayana is used, as pointed out previously in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, where it clearly has the meaning of convergence, okay? Where everything comes together as one, okay? This is what Ekayana means. And so this teaching on Satipatthana is quite consciously and quite deliberately placed by the redactors of the early canon in the Brahmanical context, where it was an adoption of terminology and ideas current within the Brahmanical strata and other strata as well, also found in the Jains, and adapted to a Buddhist perspective. Okay, now this again is another perspective on Satipatthana which tends to be lost in the later traditions. Okay, so in the commentary to this passage, Ekayana Oyam Bhikkhave Maggo, and when it gives the commentary to that, it doesn't mention anything about the Brahmanical usage of the word Ekayana. It gives you all of these different meanings for it. It's one path that one goes by oneself. It's a path which is one. There's only one path. It's a path which does not dvedha patha bhuta. It's not divided into two. Okay? And it's a path which is gone by one, or is to be gone by oneself. Okay? So on and so forth. So different kinds of meaning that it gives. Now, why does it give you these kinds of different kinds of meanings for the phrase? Well, two possible interpretations. One is that it has many different kinds of meanings, and it's not meant to be different. Not meant to have just one interpretation. Oh, here's the Brahmanical verse, by the way. This thus as was said by Brahma Sahampati. So here he's quoting from the Samyutta Nikaya. Ekayanayam. It's the one convergence of the, for one who sees the ending of birth, the path one understands, the one of great compassion. By this path, by this path, they crossed over, they will cross over, and they are crossing over. So those who cross over the flood in the past, the present, and the future, all of them will cross over by means of this particular practice, the Ekayana Magga. So here's the words of Brahma Sahampati. So it mentions the quote here, but doesn't look at the Brahmanical context, which is kind of lost to the Buddhist tradition. So all these different explanations. In the Chinese translations, again, many different explanations. It says, Iru Dao, like the one entrance path. It says, I Chu Dao, the one vehicle path. The Yo I Dao, there is one path, and so on. And all of that's telling us that the later Buddhist commentators and so on probably didn't really know what this phrase meant anymore. They'd lost the context which gave it meaning, and so they had to try to reinvent the meaning of the term. Okay? So this again is giving us some tips to look at different ways and different perspectives of particular texts. Because that's not necessarily a bad thing, you know? This is something that goes on all the time. We have to reinvent things to have a meaning for ourselves, yeah? If that meaning is lost, then people reinvent it. They imbue it with meaning. Yeah? It doesn't necessarily mean there's anything wrong with that. You've imbued it with meaning. But it does mean that if you want to say, well, what was the Buddha talking about? Then it's not necessarily going to reveal to you what the Buddha meant by it. It might reveal to you what other monks and commentators have meant by it, which is fine. But if you want to find out what the Buddha meant, then you want to look at the context that the Buddha was speaking in. Okay?
One recalls and remembers what one did long ago.
Yeah. That's the standard definition of sati, is that one remembers and understands, recalls what one was said and done long ago. Yeah.
And now in the Anguttara Nikaya, when the foremost disciples discourse, Ananda is foremost in sati.
In sati, yeah.
Memory, because he's the one who has memorized most of the
sutras. Yeah. Yeah.
a Vaisakya is four Western Sati, then he would be very highly developed in that sense that Satipatthana, he would have already attained higher meditative attainments.
Yeah. Okay. So, now...
I don't know if you're going to do it in this class, but maybe the passage in the Upanishad that I don't know if everyone's heard it, the one about all the different
experiences. Yeah, going on. I didn't read that out a couple of weeks ago, I think last week or something, so let me leave that. Right.
Yeah.
Everyone. So in the session so far we've kind of problematized the whole question of Satipatthana, rather than coming out and saying this is what Satipatthana is and here's a really kind of simple, straightforward way you can practice it, okay? Right? I'm trying to make everything as complicated as possible and swirl it up and make it murky. Okay, because I want you to question your assumptions and to look at things in as many different ways. I certainly don't want you to come out of here and then say, oh yeah, Sujato solved all the problems on Satipatthana and this is what it means, okay? And that's kind of a bit of a waste of time. But to try to open up different ways of looking at it and to examine how we come to our conclusions. And to accept it's okay to doubt about these things. It's all right, you know, we're not going to destroy Buddhism. Right, so I'm not trying to destroy the Dhamma, okay? Like the Four Noble Truths, you know, it still hurts, dukkha still hurts, you know, no matter how much text criticism you do, dukkha still hurts, right? And there's nothing you can do about that, okay? Unfortunately, if we could get rid of dukkha by doing text criticism, that would be wonderful, right? But we can't. So it's not that kind of thing, but what we're looking at is what's our relationship with the teachings. It's very, very important to look at these things. And so there's many different aspects of it. What I might try to do, bearing in mind some of those things that I've mentioned, the intertextuality, the way that Satipatthana is treated in different aspects of the canon, between the Pali canon and other canons, okay? And also the intratextuality, the way it relates to what came before and what goes afterwards, okay? So it's maintaining ideas in time, right? And these things are all very, very fascinating. You know, for example, we might say, you know, such and such is a teaching, you know, on Satipatthana. We might write a modern book about it, okay, like I did. You know, I write a book, and then in the book I put a quote. Okay, so this is intratextuality. Okay, so this is a quote from the suttas, the 2,500-year-old phrase, which I've cut and pasted and put into my own book. The suttas were also doing all that kind of thing all the time, okay? This is intratextuality. So just to bear in mind these very, very complex relationships between all the different parts of the text. Now, so what I might do, and the method that I took in History of Mindfulness, or part of the method that I took in History of Mindfulness, was to work with Satipatthana from the most basic concepts on up, okay, so rather than starting with the developed Satipatthana Sutta. One of the basic hypotheses of textual criticism is that texts tend to grow over time, okay, and this is especially true of sacred texts because you never want to be responsible for getting rid of anything that the Buddha might have said, okay? You don't mind expanding and explaining it a bit, right? You don't mind bringing in different teachings from different places, but you don't want to actually be responsible for losing something which maybe is going to get somebody enlightened, okay? And so the texts tend to, and it's not a universal thing, but there's a tendency to accrete textual material. And so what that suggests is, if that applies in our present context, then the Satipatthana Sutta is the longest of all the teachings on Satipatthana in the canon. Perhaps, and this isn't a conclusion, it's a hypothesis, perhaps that also means it's the latest of all the teachings. Okay? So not necessarily it's the most authentic, but it's the latest because it's grown such a great degree. It's been people being able to put things in there from one stage to another. And so then we take that and we say, well, we don't need all of those little suttas because they're just saying the same thing that's included in here already. So this is always the tendency, is that we tend to dismiss the early things. They tend to get replaced by the later ones. And all the traditions tend to do this. So what we do is to try to deconstruct that whole process by turning it upside down and by looking, I mean, when I did the book, I mean, go back and looking at the Vedic, the Brahmanical, the yogic backgrounds and so on. I can't go into that in all detail today, but to look even within the suttas, just to go back to the very basics, like what are the actual words used and sort of the, and then the phrases, and then from the phrases to the short passages, and then to the short suttas, and then the medium length suttas. And so you're kind of building up a picture of Satipatthana from a different perspective, okay? And so this is what I'll try to do this a little bit now, and go through the different aspects, okay? So first thing is, what is Satipatthana? Now, we talked about this a little while ago. What is the basic role of Satipatthana in the past? Now, remember that Buddhism, of course, the Buddha always said he taught the Four Noble Truths. We've seen this in suttas like the Samaditti Sutta, where everything is included within the Four Noble Truths. And so the Buddha is quite explicitly saying that this is like an overarching framework within all the teachings can be seen. So where does Satipatthana fit in within the Four Noble Truths? Okay, remembering that this is the direction that those studying Buddhism in those days would have learnt it from. Okay, you start out learning the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, teaches the Four Noble Truths, suffering, the origin, cessation, the path. Okay, what is the path? Right view, right thought, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right samadhi. So what is right mindfulness? Right mindfulness is the four Satipatthanas. Okay, what are the four Satipatthanas? And then the contemplation of the body, feelings, mind, and dhammas. So it's within that whole overall framework that we're having a detailed explanation of one part of the path, okay? And what is its function within the path as a whole? So here we have some passages I've collected from the suttas that tell us that quite explicitly. So these are passages which can be regarded as what they call Nayatha suttas. So the Buddha divided his teachings into two kinds, Nitatha and Nayatha. Nitatha means the meaning, literally means the meaning has been drawn out. So I shouldn't say Nayatha, this is Nitatha. Nitatha means the meaning has been drawn out. Okay, so in other words, it's explicit teachings. Okay, and then the Nayatha suttas are the ones whose meaning is required to be drawn out. Okay. Okay, so the Nitatha suttas would be suttas which are quite definitive and straightforward in their explanation. Nayatha ones might be, say, a simile or a poem, okay, or an allusion or a paradox, or those places where the Buddha sits down. We've seen in the Majjhima Nikaya sometimes he'll sit down, like in the Madhupindika Sutta, give an enigmatic statement, then get up and leave his seat, and all the monks are saying, what's going here? It's a Nayatha Sutta. It needs to be drawn out, needs to be explained. So they go and they find out and they get the explanation that's drawn out. So these particular passages, this one is a Nitatha passage in that it's quite straightforward and quite definitive and explicit. And this particular passage is the definition of noble right samadhi, Arya Sama Samadhi. And this is with its vital conditions and its prerequisites. And this particular definition is found through all of the four Nikayas. And again, according to the principle I mentioned before, suggestive that it's fundamental. It's included in all the four Nikayas because the redactors wanted everybody to understand this particular definition. What is noble right samadhi with its vital conditions and its prerequisites? So the question is, what is samadhi? There are right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness. Okay, so the first seven factors of the path. One pointedness of mind equipped with these seven factors is called noble right samadhi with its vital conditions and also with its prerequisites. Okay, so in other words, or in this particular definition, all the path factors are seen as being, their basic function is to support right samadhi. Okay, so going on to the next definition, one pointedness, this one we met in the Chula Vedala Sutta. One pointedness of mind is samadhi. The four Satipatthanas are the basis, the nimitta for samadhi. Okay, so again, the causal principle here. And again, it's just another example of the same thing. It is indeed to be expected, Bhante, that for a faithful, noble disciple whose energy is roused, so they have right energy, and whose mindfulness is established, okay, as they have the Satipatthana, that having made relinquishment the support, okay, so having letting go as their support or their basis, they will gain samadhi, they will gain one pointedness of mind. Okay? And again, as we saw in the division of the path into sila, samadhi, panya, that Satipatthana is always included within the Samadhi section of the path rather than the Panya section of the path. So all of these things are suggesting that, and we've also found other suttas that say, for example, that the path factors each condition each other, and so right mindfulness is a condition for right samadhi. So all of these passages are suggesting that in the context of the path as a whole, that a primary or basic function of Satipatthana is to be support for right samadhi, that is, of course, the four jhanas. Okay? So that doesn't exhaust the meaning of Satipatthana. That doesn't say it means that and nothing else. Okay? But it does mean that that's a major context. So when the monks and nuns in those days were approaching the subject and trying to learn about Satipatthana, they would have come, that would have been the initial teaching. So it's the initial understanding. Oh, okay, Satipatthana is like it's a samadhi nimitta. It's the support for samadhi. And then you go on to learn in more detail about how it is the support for samadhi. Okay? Okay. Now, so what does Satipatthana actually mean? It's divided into two words, sati and upatthana. Okay? Now, okay, don't be fooled by the Pali form here. The Pali form is Satipatthana, which suggests that it's resulting in sati and patthana, and that's often how the commentary explains it. Not always, but the commentary often explains it that way. Patthana meaning cause or basis. But that definition, although it's become very common, and that's the basis of the modern rendering, this foundations of mindfulness, but it's clearly incorrect. And there's no doubt about that. I mean, it's very straightforward. When sati appears with a verb in the suttas, it always appears with the verb upattapeti, as down here, upattapeti, which is just the verbal form of Satipatthana. Okay? And so clearly the derivation is to upatthana and not to patthana, and of course that's also the Sanskrit rendering is always smritupasthana. I don't know if I can find the Sanskrit written down there.
Sanskrit has a different reading.
No. Somewhere else. I don't know if I put it there. But anyway, that's pretty obvious that that's the actual meaning of it. It's Satipatthana. Now the difference between these two meanings comes back to what we were talking about before, is that the patthana is a more objective meaning and upatthana is a more subjective meaning. Okay, so patthana symbolizes those things on which you base your samadhi, on which you base your mindfulness, okay, is patthana. Whereas upatthana means the act of establishing or focusing one's mindfulness. Okay? So they're different emphasis. One is an objective, it's what you base it on, and upatthana is how you approach or basic meaning is to stand near, to serve or approach. Okay? Now, and in fact, it seems to be related to the Upanishadic term upasana, which has a similar meaning, which means something like to worship in the Upanishads. Again, it's one of these bridging terms that bridges the idea of worship and the idea of contemplation. So it's almost like worshipful contemplation. Okay, so you worship Brahma by contemplating him. Yeah. So it's again one of these bridge words. And it seems to be that upatthana is playing the same role in the Pali or in the Buddhist canon that upasana did in the Brahmanical scriptures. So the idea here is that when we use the word Satipatthana, what we're talking about is the act, the subjective act of establishing of one's mindfulness, of one's sati, okay, whatever that means. Okay.
So the wrong understanding of the word.
Yeah.
How does that affect the modern day presenters of it?
Well, again, it tends to shift the emphasis onto the object rather than the subject. Okay. So it tends to shift the emphasis onto the things that you're mindful of rather than the internal. Okay?
What does that mean rather than internal?
Like you said before, elements out there kind of thing, in a way. It's kind of like something external to yourself, in a sense. Mm-hmm.
No. When a feeling arises, and objectifying the feeling, in the sense that I'm talking about now, would be the tendency to look at the feeling, okay? Feeling arises, you look at the feeling, okay? And see what the feeling is like. But the subjective aspect of it would be to look at or to reflect on or to focus on how you're looking at the feeling and how the feeling affects the mind. Okay, so it's not looking at that thing out there, but it's looking at that act of paying attention to it. Okay, so again, it's not a hard and fast distinction by any means, and it's not that one way is wrong and one way is right, but there's just a slight shift in the emphasis between saying your job in meditation is to look at that feeling which arises, okay, and to say your job in meditation is to look at the way, how you look at the feeling, what's your relationship between yourself and that feeling, okay?
That's fantastic.
Yeah, and so there's just this nuance of difference. It's not by no means hard and fast. It's just like a very, very subtle kind of tendency. Okay?
So which Bhante is the correct one?
Upatthana, the subjective form. Yeah. It's the act of focusing attention. Yeah. So in other words, the four satipatthanas doesn't mean four things on which you base your mindfulness. Okay. It means four ways in which you can focus your mindfulness. Okay. Does that make sense? Now, this phrase, the satipatthana, is used normally in the gradual training. Okay, so we've met the gradual training many times in the Majjhima Nikaya, and I've already remarked upon this that we have the phrase sating upat parimukhang sating upat petwa. One establishes mindfulness parimukhang. Okay, and in the gradual training, of course, if we remember, starts out with. I'm just trying to think of where. Oh, okay, here we go. So this tells us the role of satipatthana in the gradual training, right? So this correlates different ways of presenting the parts in terms of being more or less detailed. But if you look at the gradual training here, so we have Sila Samadhi Panya here, the gradual training, first of all, hearing the teaching, gaining faith in the teaching, going forth, undertaking the rules of discipline, purifying livelihood, practicing contentment, sense restraint, moderation in eating, wakefulness, clear comprehension, seclusion, and then establishing mindfulness, okay, which is satipatthana. Then abandoning hindrances, practicing the four jhanas, and so on and so on and so forth. Okay, so now the role of specifically, so again, leaving aside our ideas of what mindfulness is, forget what mindfulness is. You don't know anything about mindfulness, right? But in the text, where it actually uses the phrase sating upatthapetwa, having established mindfulness, it uses it specifically in this particular context. Completed all the preliminary practices and learning and everything like that, and then finally you sit under the tree, cross your legs, establish mindfulness, okay, and then abandon the hindrances, develop the four jhanas, and so on and so forth. So again, this is establishing a basic, fundamental context, which is taught again and again and again and again and again throughout all the suttas, all the four nikayas, the Abhidhamma, the Vinaya. They all contain this teaching, okay. Again and again and again. And so this is a very, very basic context. And in this context, satipatthana provides specifically and solely the function of basically meditation. Right? It's what we mean when we say we're going to do meditation. We sit down, watch your breath coming in and out, abandon the hindrances, go into jhanas and realize enlightenment. That's what we do when we sit meditation. Well, at least that's what we... In theory, that's what we do when we sit meditation. So this is what... That's specifically what satipatthana is. So again, I'm not trying to reify this. I'm not trying to say this is all that it is and it is nothing else, but I'm just focusing on specifically what is the actual text saying. And so this is particularly an important context. So the term parimukha, again, well, we don't go into all the details of parimukha, but possibly meaning presence, so in establishing a presence of mindfulness. Bhikkhu Bodhi translates in front. Okay, so this is giving us some idea of what satipatthana, how it functions in the path as a whole. Okay, so it could continue on a couple of different ways of mindfulness is treated in the suttas here. The phrase we referred to earlier, a noble disciple is mindful, endowed with highest mindfulness and self-control, able to remember, self-control being reflective of sense restraint, able to remember to keep in memory what was said and done long ago. So this is a standard definition found in many places in the canon. Okay, so we then come to the so these are the basic ideas of satipatthana. Now, We then come to the idea of what we call the Satipatthana formula, okay, or the basic pericope is used in the textual sense. And of course this is the basic passage which is found at the beginning of the, or near the beginning of the Satipatthana Sutta, which goes, Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation. Here Bhikkhu is a bhikkhu, and you will notice, I should just...
This is your new rendering,
right? You will notice that here, in the to prove that I've resurrected the actual original structure of the Satipatthana Sutta, and that there's no programmatic elements involved here. It says here, a monk or nun abides contemplating a body in the body internally. Okay? Here, how are monks and nuns? Does a monk or nun abide contemplating a body in the body? Here, a monk or nun abides, and so on and so forth. So, that's actually justified by one of the texts, the Sarvastivadin version. So,
the Sarvastivadin version has because between.
Yeah. Yeah, part and some
it's
of.
He.
Sorry.
It's not a he. I mean, nuns are he.
Yeah, it just gets really ugly. I tried, but it gets really ugly. Yeah, he or she. And
well, he or she is clumsy.
Yeah. I did my best. Anyway, so here a bhikkhu or bhikkhuni abides contemplating a body as a body, ardent, fully aware, and mindful, having put away covetousness and grief for the world. He abides contemplating feelings and feelings. Mind as mind, or dhammas as dhammas, ardent, fully aware, and mindful, having put away covetousness and grief for the world. So this is what we refer to as the basic Satipatthana formula, okay? And in a similar way to have like the jhana formula, or the Four Noble Truths formula, and so on. And these are basic textual units which are found scattered, you know, like pepper in the suttas. They're everywhere you open it, and there's these different phrases found all over the place. And usually with very little variation. I mean, there are a few minor variations in it, which we might have a look at a bit later, but pretty consistently and found pretty in a similar form. So obviously this is a very important expression of what Satipatthana actually is. And so again, taking our method of building up from the very short, simple, basic things, we'll come back and have a look at what the different phrases in this formula mean, okay? And of course one of the things being the body, the actual four satipatthanas, the body, the feelings of mind and dhammas, which we'll have a look at, but we'll have a look at the actual overall formula first, okay? Now, is this the most basic formula? This is one question which we could ask. You have a shorter version found in the Sarvastivadin text and in the later Pali text. It says the establishing of mindfulness of contemplating a body in the body. Okay, so rather than saying ardent, clearly comprehending and mindful, having removed covetousness and grief for the world, it basically just says you do the Satipatthana of contemplating a body in the body. Okay, so it's a shorter, simpler version. And so the question arises, and that appears in the same place that the fuller text appears in the Pali. So then the question arises, which is early? Is one of them the original one? Is one an expanded version of the other? Or is one a compressed version of the other? Or are they simply two alternatives? Okay, and that's a point of some interest as it happens. Again, without going into all the details, there's a particular little note in the Chinese text of the Satipatthana Sanyutta, and just has this little note at the end of one of the suttas. Okay, so just, you know, after an odd number of suttas, it then has all sutras on the four Satipatthanas are to end with the following phrase. That is, therefore, a monk developing and practicing the four Satipatthanas, giving rise to exalted aspirations. Not quite sure what that means. With refined striving and skillful means, with right mindfulness and right knowledge, should train. Okay, so this is, again, without going into all the textual flibble flobbles, but this is a version of the same basic formula we find in the Theravada. Partly the differences arise through the Chinese renderings, and partly the difference arises through the way that it was abbreviated. But the interesting thing about this is that it tells us that all of them are to be expanded, okay? In other words, wherever we find this abbreviated formula, we're actually told by the text itself to expand that into the full formula. Okay, so we know that the abbreviated formula was just an abbreviation that was used by the writers. Okay, because somebody had to pay, right, for somebody to sit down and write, either in Chinese or in Sanskrit. It could have come at either stage, and someone had to actually pay somebody to sit and write them. Or even if they were monks and you got free labor for the monks to do it, or nuns to do it, but you still had to pay for the actual paper, which was not cheap. Yeah. And so you, rather than copying out the same formula again and again and again, they were abbreviated. Now, one of the things that that's important for is that I mentioned we have of course the different versions of the Satipatthana Sutta, right? Now, the Sarvasivadin version of this sutta is found in the Madhyama, Sarvasivadin Madhyama Agama, as is the Theravadin. Okay. Now, come back to the question I raised before. What's the relationship between these suttas and the big group of suttas in the Satipatthana Samyutta dealing with the topic? Now, my feeling and my suggestion is that at an earlier stage of evolution of the canon, all of the suttas on Satipatthana were collected within the Satipatthana Samyutta. And this is part of my theory on the nine angas, which I've mentioned a few times. And as at a later stage of development of the canon, when the four Nikayas were created, the four Nikayas were created essentially in order to divide the canon into manageable chunks for memorization. Okay, so when the original canon canonical collection became too cumbersome, it was broken up and made into these chunks. And so bits were moved out of the different collections in the Samyutta into the other parts of the canon. So this is my essential theory on how the four Nikayas were created. And in this particular case, the theory would be that what we call the Satipatthana Sutta, okay, fulfilled the role within the Samyutta of other kinds of suttas which are generally known by the term of a Vibhanga Sutta, okay? Now the Vibhanga Suttas give us an analysis and an explanation of the key terms in a teaching, which is then to be read into other contexts. So, for example, in dependent origination, it says, you know, what is ignorance, and this ignorance is this, and what is sankharas, and sankharas is that, and so on. And so all the other suttas abbreviate it, but of course you're meant to understand the terms as they're explained in that one place. So I think that what we call the Satipatthana Sutta played that kind of role within the Satipatthana Samyutta at an earlier stage of development. When that was broken up, this was lifted out of the Satipatthana Samyutta and put into the Majjhima. And at that stage, it was expanded, extra material was put into it in order to make it into a middle-length discourse. So this is why it's much longer than all of the discourses in the Satipatthana Samyutta. Now, that's just a theory, but what we have here is a specific piece of textual information which allows us to give what I think is a very strong verification of that theory. Within Satipatthana Samyutta, okay, of course 70 suttas, all talking about Satipatthana, and they all have the Satipatthana formula, and it's very easy to understand why the reciters or the copyists would want to abbreviate it. Okay, they abbreviate it, and conveniently enough in the Chinese they put a note there saying they should all be expanded. We've abbreviated these, so it's all very clear and it's perfectly straightforward. Now, what isn't straightforward is why is the Sarvasivadin version of the Satipatthana Sutta in the Majjhima, why that is also abbreviated. So this also has the abbreviated version of the Satipatthana formula. Why is that the case? Okay. This appears by itself, not in the context of another 70 suttas dealing with Satipatthana, where we've already heard the formula so many times we've got bored with it, right? This appears by itself without suttas on Satipatthana around it, okay? And it's also a very long sutta. To actually abbreviate that formula, it would, you know, it creates an almost negligible difference in the overall length of the sutta, okay? So there doesn't seem to be any good reason why the editors would abbreviate the formula in that context, okay? So I think that the best explanation for that is that the formula was already abbreviated when this belonged to the Samyutta, okay? Then when it was moved into the Majjhima was created, then kept that abbreviated form. Okay, so that's like a specific text critical reason for thinking that the Majjhima and presumably the Digha versions of the Satipatthana Sutta originally belonged in the Samyutta.
You mentioned before that if there wasn't the Satipatthana Sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya, possibly the Digha as well, that there would be no teachings on mindfulness.
Well, not quite. I mean, there's still the basic teachings on mindfulness and so on.
The Eightfold Path
and so on. It's not defined in such detail, yeah. And, you know, you have other related suttas like the Anapanasati Sutta and Kayanganasati Sutta and things. But, yeah, you certainly don't have that listing of all the different meditation techniques and things. Right? Okay, so this is the formula we've been talking about. Atapi sampajano satima vineya loke abhidhya domanasan. So one contemplates mind for contemplation of the body, and clearly comprehending and mindful, having removed for the world covetousness and grief. Now, atapi obviously refers to practice of right effort. Sampajana is the wisdom dimension, and particularly sampajanya is mentioned in two main contexts in the suttas. One context is what we call mindfulness in daily life, okay, where the term actually uses sampajanya rather than sati, and that means, you know, going out and returning when acts with clear comprehension and so on. So that's one context where sampajanya tends to be used. The other context is in the third jhana formula, okay? So in the context of what we call mindfulness in daily life, also important to remember that although we tend to, again, think of that as somehow we pass on our practice, in fact that's not true at all. In the suttas, the practice of mindfulness in daily life is invariably presented as one of the foundational practices leading up to the development of the four jhanas, okay? In itself, it's neither samatha nor vipassana, okay? It's a foundation for both. But in the context of the path, it's invariably presented as a foundation for the practice of jhanas. And sampajanya itself is very commonly mentioned in the four jhana formula, okay? And not in the context of vipassana. It is occasionally, of course, there's always occasional uses, but these are the common uses of it. And vineya loke abhidhya domanasan is very similar to the phrase in the practice of sense restraint. So it's related to the practice of sense restraint. So what these things are implying is that those preliminary practices, which we've seen above here in the gradual training, okay, so we've seen these gradual training, the practice of sense restraint, the practice of wakefulness, clear comprehension. Okay, so this auxiliary formula is suggesting that these things are part of or perhaps a precondition for developing Satipatthana. And one of the interesting things is to notice the connection between this formula. See, this formula has no parallels or nothing similar to this formula anywhere in the suttas that's specifically in a context dealing with vipassana meditation. Okay? So when we look at this, you know, many, many dozens of suttas dealing with contemplation of the khandhas as impermanent or contemplation of dependent origination or contemplation of the six ayatanas as not self and all of these kinds of things. When we look in those contexts, we never find the word mindfulness. We never find the word Satipatthana. We never find anything vaguely resembling this kind of formula describing the meditation. But we do find something very similar in the context of loving kindness, okay, development of metta meditation. And it uses this formula, vigadabhijo vigadabhyapado asammulho sampajano patisato metta sahagatena chetasa, so development of with a heart full of loving kindness. So you see that the phrasing here, vigadabhijo, without abhijha, without covetousness, this is similar to the abhijha here, vigadabhyapado, abandoning of ill will, this abandoning of the domanasa, asammulho, and that's basically not confused, so it's a synonym for being mindful. Sampajana patisato, and again a similar synonym for being mindful. So this phrase actually is very similar, in fact almost identical in meaning, to the phrase that we have pendant to Satipatthana constantly, and obviously referring to a samatha practice. And again, nothing even vaguely similar in any vipassana practices. Okay?
When in the Anapanasati Sutta he talks about establishing mindfulness and by doing it you build up the seven factors of enlightenment. Mm-hmm. It's like it feels like that's giving mindfulness a slightly different emphasis. You know, that you need mindfulness in the mind. I mean, that's really clear that you need mindfulness in the mind as a factor for all the other factors yep. to come into being, and that it plays this, that it plays this role of balancing and guarding the mind,
yep.
both in the powers and in yep. the faculties. So, just from what you're saying, you're really talking about how it becomes a basis for dharma. Mm. But that, I'm just thinking of the other sutras where he's talking about sati and these different functions.
Mm. But it's really the same function. I mean, in the context of the five faculties, it was the quote that we read earlier, one of them was in the context of the five faculties, and it says, it's to be expected that a noble disciple who's developed the faculty of sati will develop the right samadhi. Yeah? And similarly, in the seven enlightenment factors, most of the enlightenment factors are all talking about samatha qualities. And so the sati, rapture, is the only vipassana quality. The rest of them are all samatha qualities. Energy, tranquility, rapture. Energy, what's the function of energy?
Energy is a factor independent of jhana.
Yeah, but that's not quite the point. What's the basic function of energy is to overcome sloth and torpor as a hindrance.
Yeah? You have to have energy for sati. You have to have a mind that has energy for sati.
Exactly.
So
it's helping you to overcome the hindrance of sloth and torpor.
Well, but it also, sati isn't just for... it does, but that it isn't the only reason that you do sati is to overcome the hindrance.
But that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying if you want to ask, again, keeping it very, very specific... My energy, what is the basic function of energy? The basic function of energy is to overcome sloth and torpor. Okay? That's not to say it hasn't got a million other contexts, right? But the basic purpose of it is to overcome sloth and torpor. Right? And that's one of the hindrances, which is what you do on your way to jhanas.
But even if energy didn't mean that, then in the context of this...
What else could it possibly mean?
It's the basic requirement of right effort, which is letting go of all the unwholesome states, not just sloth and torpor. It's the whole thing of letting go of unwholesomeness and building wholesome states based on right effort, which is energy.
That's true, and so it is broader than that. But still, basically, energy overcomes tiredness. That's what energy is. Yeah, so I'm just trying to keep it really grounded because we get too abstracted and we want to generalize everything. But just keep it very, very simple. Energy overcomes tiredness. That's the basic function. That's not saying it hasn't got a million other functions, but the basic function is energy overcomes tiredness.
I just have to say I have a different perspective because right effort is part of the Eightfold Path. It is a key factor, and it's not just about overcoming tiredness. It really is about overcoming all unwholesome states. It's abandoning all unwholesome states as part of right effort.
In the definition of right effort, it's overcoming akusala dhammas.
Mm.
And when you read the jhana formula, it's secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states, unwholesome dhammas.
Akusala dhammas, yeah.
So right effort is getting rid of akusala dhammas. When you develop the four jhanas, you overcome the akusala dhammas.
Yeah.
Not for mindfulness too, for any of these.
Well, that's what it is, isn't it? You use energy. Energy overcomes akusala dhammas.
Mm.
That means when you've overcome them, you've overcome the hindrance. When you overcome the hindrance, that leads to jhana factors.
Yeah.
It's quite simple.
Yeah.
So basically, Vanke Jhana is enlightenment.
Well, that's an inference.
Jhana is
just right samadhi, that's all.
Yeah, but in Hinduism, they talk about enlightenment as being a very high form of samadhi.
Yeah.
They've got like four samadhis.
Yeah.
And there's like...
Nirvikalpa samadhi.
Yeah, and then there's another one, something like Sahaja samadhi.
Yeah.
In which is continuous.
Yeah.
When you're awake or asleep.
Yeah.
So, where is the difference?
What do you mean, where's the difference?
Well, in Hinduism, they talk about the universal self. Buddhism, there is no self.
Yeah.
Is that the main difference? Because they're both talking about, Hinduism is talking about samadhi as being the ultimate state.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I guess so, yeah.
Yeah.
I guess we have to look at the...
So it's just a matter of what you use the samadhi for.
Yeah. Yeah.
To see...
Yep. So, but just to come back to the point we were talking about before we got into the argument about right effort, but leaving aside right effort, all of the other enlightenment factors are very specifically samatha qualities, rapture, tranquility, samadhi, and equanimity, okay, and so mindfulness stands at the beginning of them. Again, so again, mindfulness, the basic role of it is to develop primarily samatha qualities. Again, I'm not trying to reify these things. I'm trying to deconstruct. I'm not trying to reify. Okay? So I'm not trying to say it is this and it is nothing else. I'm trying to say that there is a way of looking at it which is different from what we've heard. And so I'm continually trying to present that different perspective to get us to deconstruct that. Later on we can come and build it up again. Okay? So, and again, you know, I'm trying to present what hasn't been presented. That's all. Not trying to say that it's necessarily the be-all and end-all. Okay.
Yes, like we've been taught to look at it through our preconceived.
Yeah. So we have to look at, we have to try to look at it from another, we have to wrench ourselves out of that and try to look at it another way as best we can. Then later on we can be a bit more flexible about it. So here I've collected a number of different variations on the Satipatthana formula. Okay, I just collected various ones from the suttas. It's probably got most of the different variations. They're very similar. There's nothing... Most of these, again, we referred to, these are some of the ones which Venerable Analia was referring to in his thing, but most of them are fairly kind of standard kinds of things, okay? So, you know, where it says, contemplating the body, by doing this, then one abandons all bad, unwholesome dhammas, okay, or crushes. And these are the kinds of things that we find said about different qualities and so on through the sutta. So you can't draw any hugely... specific conclusions from these kinds of phrases. Similarly here, you know, you do body contemplation and then the mind is experiences dispassion and release and is freed from the defilements and things like this. These are very general kinds of statements. They're not very specific. But there's a few places where we find more specific variations, and when those specific variations come up is these ones, when contemplating the body, in the body, ardent, clearly comprehending, so we notice a similarity here. Atapi, sampajano is just a different grammatical thing. Ekodi bhuta, okay, one pointed. Vipassana chitta, and with mind which is bright and clarified, that's very similar to the phrasing of the second jhana formula. Concentrated in samadhi and one pointed, okay. So this is, again, this is a passage from the Sangyutta describing how one should do Satipatthana. And again, another one, again in the Sangyutta, I'm clearly comprehending and mindful, one understands I'm blissful. Okay? So, practicing, my mind becomes concentrated, my mind goes into samadhi, and the defilements are abandoned. Okay? And again, by contemplating thus, one goes into right samadhi, into right clarity, vipassiddhi. Again, this is the same word as we found up here, vipassana citta, a different form of it, the same word, similar to the second jhana formula. And here, contemplating the body in the body, one should not think thoughts, ma vitakkang vitakesi, associated with the body. Okay? So again, this is suggestive of a samadhi context, because of course overcoming vitakka is one of the functions of jhanas. So in these brief variations, so this is probably most or all of the passages in the suttas where we have brief, short variations or developments of the basic Satipatthana Sutta context. Okay, and in these we don't find anywhere where specifically and explicitly vipassana is being taught. There's nowhere where it says, thus contemplating Satipatthana, one abides contemplating impermanence in the XYZ, or one abides contemplating the causality of XYZ. Okay, so there's nothing like that. We find either just general statements that it leads to abandoning of defilements and so on. And when it gets more specific, invariably it's talking about developing of samadhi qualities. Okay. And when we start to look a bit further afield, this picture is also confirmed. And here's a few fragments of the Satipatthana formula found from various Sanskrit sources. And these, by no means an attempt to be comprehensive, it's just what I happen to stumble across in my casual reading of things like the Pratyutpana Buddha Sammukhava Sthita Samadhi Sutra and other kinds of things that you sort of pick up while waiting in the dentist's lounge or something like that. So here we have the Sarvasivadin Mahaparinirvana Sutta. This is very similar to the Pali version. Atapi samprajana smritiman vinaya bidhya loke dharmanasyang. Okay, so that's basically the same as the Pali version. Kaye kaya nupashino viharta kaya lamba nanu smriti tishtati santishtati. So as one contemplating the body, recollection supported by the body is set up, well set up. And it's not really conveyed by this, but these words, verbs here, tishtati, santishtati, are regularly used both in the Pali and the Sanskrit traditions to mean samadhi, okay? So the standing and steadiness of the mind. Again here, okay, the mindfulness that's... So this is from the Abhidharma Kosha, so the great Abhidharma treatise of Vasubandhu, when mindfulness becomes established, and then here... In the Pratyutpana Buddha Samukhavasthita Samadhi Sutra, Kayanu Darshi Viharati Nacha Kaya Sahagatang Vitarkang Vitarkayati. One doesn't think thoughts associated with the body. Of course, this reminding us of this passage here from the Pali, okay? From the Dantabhumi Sutta. This one. So, that little survey, what that suggests is that Satipatthana is taught often in a general sense as being a good contemplation and meditative contemplation which leads to development of good qualities, abandoning of defilements and leading to enlightenment. More specifically, is used as a basis for samadhi. Okay. So then, next bit to go on to look at the part that talks about the contemplation of the actual different idiom. So the idiom, we have this idiom here, kaye kayanupasi. So what this literally translates as a body in the body. What does this mean? Okay, and it's not at all obvious from the Pali exactly what that means, and different people give different interpretations of it. Okay, so one interpretation is that it doesn't mean anything. It's just an idiom, right? Another interpretation is that the kaye here is a locative case in the sense of with meaning with respect to. So one contemplates a body with respect to the body, okay, or regarding the body. As regards the body, one contemplates the body, and so on, whatever that means. But in the Satipatthana, in the Anapanasati Sutta, it seems to suggest that the meaning is more specifically translated as something like you contemplate an aspect of the body, okay? So it says that the breath is a certain body among the bodies, all right? Again, it's not entirely clear what that means, but it seems to be the idea that if you're sitting in meditation, there's various aspects of physical experience which one can pay attention to. So you can focus on one or other aspect of physical experience, but you choose to focus on the breath, and so you choose to focus on one particular aspect, okay? So it's like a narrowing, okay? Rather than just being anything, you're focusing on that one thing, okay? And that seems to be the implication. Oh, sorry, I missed out. Actually, the normative explanation of that is that kaya kaya nupasi means contemplating a body as only a body and not as a self. Okay, that's of course a vipassana style explanation of it, but perhaps not so plausible. Okay. So, any questions on that before we go on? So as I say, I'm going to take an analytical approach. I'm going to take one bit at a time, and I'm going to go through like a bulldozer, right? And demolish each little part of the house as we go on, okay? So if you think that you've got anything left, don't worry, it will be demolished later on, okay?
So, Bhante, the body is the body of breath.
Yeah.
And what about the body of feeling? there any reference to that?
No.
What about body of water?
Body of water?
Like the elements of water.
I'm not quite sure what you're asking.
Breath is air. I just wondered whether that, like, you got the four elements make up the body, whether that's referring to the element of air. Has it got any, like, reference like that? Or it's like you can have the element of earth as a body in the body?
The four elements is found in Satipatthana Sutta.
Yeah.
And then the breath is when it's explained, the air element is explained as the breath.
But is there any kind of reference like that?
You mean specifically a textual reference in the...
There's a reference in the Buddha saying that...
No.
It's a body.
No. That's the only thing that I've found that can actually give us a specific textual clue as to the meaning of that idiom. Yeah. Everything else is basically speculation. But that's the thing that seems to give some kind of concrete thing. So again, not necessarily trying to reduce the meaning to that and say it means this and nothing else, but trying to kind of get as concrete as we can. And okay. Anupassana. So what does anupassana mean? So one contemplates, when we say we contemplate, okay, kaya anupassi. So the next element is anupassi. So this is very important. I mean, this is actually what you're doing. We say we sit, we observe. We're the watcher, we're the observer, we're looking in our meditation. And this is the word that the Buddha has chosen to actually express that. Okay? So he's specifically chosen this one word to express that aspect of awareness within the context of Satipatthana. So it's obviously quite important to think, well, what does anupassana mean? The Buddha had many, many words at his disposal. Okay? There are dozens of words in Pali that mean to observe or to watch or to reflect or to contemplate and so on and so forth. There's many, many of them. Why did he choose this specific one, and what does it mean in this particular context? Okay? Now, the root is anu, meaning along with, okay, following, and pasana, to see or to watch. So that's very simple. In the Abhidhamma definitions, it just glosses that word. It says anupassana means, and then it gives a list of terms for understanding or for wisdom, for panya. So this is the practice in the Abhidhamma is one of the things that it does is that it acts like a thesaurus. Okay, so it identifies synonyms. Okay, so what it does is it says all these different words are equivalent to wisdom or understanding, and so then it's saying anupassana is one of these terms which is meaning understanding or wisdom. So that's the Abhidhamma understanding. So of course anupassana is also very similar in form with vipassana. Okay, and so of course it's not unnatural to see a connection between the two, the same root pasana and a different prefix of vi or anu. So of course it's similar, but also, you know, you wouldn't... The whole point of what we're trying to do here is to tease out little subtleties in the way that contemplation is done, okay? And so that's exactly the kind of subtlety which is commonly expressed in Pali through the use of a different prefix, okay? So you don't want to say just because it has the same stem or the same root word that therefore it means the same thing, because it's precisely in the subtleties which are expressed by the prefix that we want to have a look at. So let's go back and have a look at this in context as well. Okay.
What's V mean?
V is equivalent to the English di, as in discernment or deconstructing, and it's basically related to the root two, as in the number two, as in the letter V. Yeah. So it expresses that kind of analytical or splitting notion. Okay. So vipassana specifically means analytical knowledge, or not means, but suggests. The V suggests a kind of analytical, kind of cutting apart knowledge. Yeah. Whereas anu doesn't suggest that at all. Anu suggests the flowing knowledge. Yeah. Anu is flowing along. Yeah. The implications of the prefix is quite different. Okay. How is anupassana used, and does it mean non-judgmental awareness? Okay. Again, we're often told satipatthana means non-judgmental awareness, and that's what anupassana means, just being aware of whatever happens or whatever. Is that how it's used in context? Okay, so this is the earliest version I found, and this is from the Rig Veda, he contemplates the anupassanas with loving favor, the mortal who, like a rich man, pours for him the soma. Okay, Magavan, that's Indra, Sakha in Pali, with his bended arm supports him. He slays unasked the men who hate devotion. Okay, so here anupassana means obviously not non-judgmental awareness at all. It means extremely judgmental awareness. Okay, and it's almost like, you know, remember I mentioned before the idea of upasana being bridging that notion of devotion and contemplation. Yeah. So, and also the mindfulness, also similar, that recollecting sati, recollecting the sacred text as being a devotional act as well. So here it's a kind of that devotional aspect as well. So like that regard which the gods hold the mortals who make them the offerings. Okay. So perhaps that's that kind of meaning is 1,000 years before the Buddha. Perhaps it's got nothing to do with what the Buddha was saying. So what does it say here in the Dhammapada? He is no friend who is ever diligently suspecting dissension, contemplating only flaws. Okay, so anupassana, only the bad side. Okay, so going with the fault-finding rhyme. But on whom one rests like a child at the breast, he is a true friend who is not alienated by others. Okay, so this is a verse from the Sutta Nipata.
It's quite clear, doesn't it? Non-judgmental.
Yeah. And again from the Dhammapada, for one who contemplates anupassana as the faults of another, whose thoughts are always critical, his defilements increase, he is far from the evaporation of defilements. Okay? And again, the emphasis, it particularly says eva, okay? And then sada and nichan, constantly watching only one side of things, okay? And so these passages are useful because these are like ordinary language passages. These are not technical meditation passages. So these are the context from which the technical usages are drawing, okay? Again, in the Isha Upanishad, which may be later than the Buddha, he who contemplates all beings just as the self, and the self as all beings, he is not revulsed because of that. When all beings are just the self for the discerning one, then what delusion, what sorrow for one who contemplates oneness. Okay? And so, sounds similar to like the practice of metta or loving kindness, you know, contemplating all beings as oneself. And again, here has a meaning of, I explained it here, you're seeing two sides of things. You see all beings as the self and the self as all beings, and then resolve that surface duality into a deeper unity. Okay? So the idea here is you're moving from that duality of separation of self and others, and then through that contemplation, bringing together, you're moving to the contemplation of oneness. Okay?
Because that's what Brahmanism is about oneness with Brahma.
Yeah.
Yeah. And
that
oneness leads to
Yep. And again, other different contexts here. One control of the many inactive, who makes the one seed manifold, standing in the self, the wise who contemplate him, to them belongs eternal bliss, not to others. Okay, so again, the connection between the contemplation, the anupassana, and the one. If one clearly contemplates him as the self, as the Lord, what will become and what will be, one does not shrink away from him. Okay? Then another usage again from the Pali, from the Dhammapada, and this is coming closer to the meaning or the usage in Satipatthana itself, because it's talking about Subha and Asubha being one of the topics in the Kayanupassana section of Satipatthana. One who abides contemplating beauty, so Subha, unrestrained in his sense faculties, immoderate in eating, lazy, with deficient energy, truly, Mara overthrows him or her as the wind a weak tree. Okay? One who abides contemplating ugliness, restrained in his or her sense faculties, moderate in eating, faithful with roused up energy, truly, Mara does not overthrow him or her as the wind a rocky mountain. Okay? So again, here, contemplation Anupassana means focusing specifically on one side of things. You're focusing on the beautiful or you're focusing on the ugly. Okay? So this is my suggestion here, and I also notice that anu, the prefix of anu, when it's used in a psychological or meditative context, has this nuance of continuing or ongoing. Okay? So we have, for example, vitaka vichara, you have vitaketi vichareti, one thinks and ponders, yeah? And then anu vitaketi, anu vichareti, one keeps on thinking and pondering. Okay? So the prefix of anu has that stretching out kind of feeling. So this is why I think anupassana has a nuance of a sustained observation. Okay? And it's very similar to the jhana factor vichara, which is glossed in the Abhidhamma Vibhanga by the two terms anusandhanata, sustained application, and anupekhanata. Anupekhanata in particular is basically identical with anupassana. Pekha just means to watch or observe, so anupekha and anupassana is basically the same meaning. And so this is applied to the jhana factor of vichara, okay, in the Abhidhamma. Sustained observation. Okay? So this is what I think anupassana means. So again, this is elucidating the meaning. Kaya kaya anupassi, contemplating a body in the body. Body in the body means you focus on a particular aspect of physical experience, for example, the breath or the four elements or the 32 parts, and then one sustains one's awareness on that particular aspect. Okay. I won't go into this too much, but just to notice that one of the basic elements of the Satipatthana formula is it talks about contemplating Satipatthana internally and contemplating externally. Okay. Again, it's not entirely clear what that means, but in this case I think the traditional understanding is fairly probably correct, and we've seen in suttas like the Mahahatipadopama Sutta talks about the four elements, so the internal earth element being like the body and so on, the external element is the kind of stuff out there. So one can contemplate and apply the contemplation in those different dimensions. There are different dimensions of how the basic framework is interpreted. But the interesting thing I think about this is that in the suttas where it talks about these two things, it says you contemplate internally. Okay, contemplates the body in body. And then it says one contemplates externally, contemplate a body in the body. And then it says contemplate internally and externally. Okay, ajanta bahidha, and puts that into a compound. And so the idea seems to be a movement towards a synthesis. Okay, and that's again explained in contexts like the Mahahatipadopama Sutta, where it says you contemplate in this body and you see this is the earth element in this body. You see the earth element outside there. And then you see, well, actually, it's just the earth element, okay? So then you're realizing there's no fundamental difference between this earth element or that earth element. So this is like moving towards a synthesis of these two things, okay?
I was thinking about the synthesis actually says that, doesn't it?
Yeah.
You do the inside, then external, and then you see what's the difference.
Yeah, that's Mahatipadopa. So it doesn't actually say that specifically in the context of Satipatthana, but that's generally how it... I think it means. Now, there is...
I'll tell you, sorry, just not a digression, but in terms of Ayurveda, when they talk about the five elements, because it's about ether, which is space, Ayurveda would have been well and truly happening in India at the time of Buddha. When they speak of the earth element, they're not actually... They're talking about the qualities of the earth element, the qualities of the air element. They're speaking of the qualities of the air element, which suggests movement.
Yep.
And the earth element suggests abilities, stockiness. So you're not just looking at physical aspects of the body, like the bones, the earth element. That's not the way that you look at it in Ayurveda. It's more the qualities. What does that component suggest in terms of the qualities of
It's not a physical aspect. Sort of say the same thing, but you start out with the lumpy physical things, so like the bones, and it sort of lists all those things, and then it says or whatever else is like solid or hard and so on. So it sort of moves from one to the other. So this is more like a, it's like the basis, you know. Just you start out by looking at what are those obvious examples of things that are solid, and then you sort of begin to look more subtly at that aspect of solidity in all things. Yeah, that's the same, isn't it? Okay. Now within the Satipatthana context of Satipatthana, there's probably only one place that's literally and specifically in the context of Satipatthana that actually talks about internal and external contemplation. I should just note that this aspect of internal and external contemplation is found broadly through the suttas, not just in the context of Satipatthana, and is used again broadly both in vipassana context and samatha context. Okay, so it's neither kind of one nor the other. It's more general than that. But the only place where it's specifically used in the context of Satipatthana is a sutta in the Digha Nikaya, and it says, well, contemplating internally, okay, contemplating the body in the body, by doing that one enters into samadhi, okay, having entered into samadhi, one then gives rise to knowledge and vision, jnana dasana, which is here a psychic power of the body of others externally, okay. And so this again seems to relate to the contemplation of mind in Satipatthana, where one contemplates one's own mind, obviously, if you have greed, hatred and delusion and so on. But also the description of the ability to read other people's minds is exactly the same. So it's also contemplating the mind with hate and without hate, with greed, without greed and so on. It's exactly the same list. So it seems to me that when talking about external contemplation, at least one meaning, and probably the only meaning that's literally got any textual justification, is to see the using of psychic powers to be able to contemplate others.
This is the traditional explanation, isn't it?
Yeah. Yep.
So they've got that one there.
Yep. Okay.
Would that be really useful to contemplate others?
I don't know. Well, I mean, we're also told many times in the suttas, you know, just watch inside, yeah, and look inside yourself. I think it's more, you know, there's certain, for example, in doing metta, you know, it's also like an external contemplation, kind of comparing oneself to others and these kinds of things. So, okay. So then going on to ekayana, so we already discussed that, the meaning of ekayana. So we already talked about ekayana in general, but just to mention that a couple of things is the word eka. In a meditation context, as far as I know, eka in a meditation context always means one-pointedness of mind, okay? It just means, well, it's just a word for one. But in meditation, it always means unification or one-pointedness of mind. And that's exactly the oldest explanation we've got for this term, okay, is found in one of the Chinese translations, which actually gives us a specific comment on this term. Why is it called the one entrance? This is their Iru Dao. The translation in this particular sutta, ekayana, it is so called because it is the way to samadhi and oneness of mind. Okay? So this is the oldest literal explanation of what this term means in the context of Satipatthana, and it specifically says it's called the ekayana path because it leads to samadhi.
What is that in? Is that in the sutta or is that in the commentary?
That's in the sutta. Ekayana Sutta of the Mahasangika, probably Mahasangika, Ekotara Agama. Okay, so again, some other things which are probably not worth discussing here. Any questions on that? So that's the main usage of the basic formula on Satipatthana. So then in the book in History of Mindfulness, I then go on to talk about the usage of Satipatthana in the Sanyutta, Satipatthana Sanyutta. I won't go into that in too much detail here. It's going to take too long, but sufficient to say that usually we just find sort of simple variations of the Satipatthana formula. It's quite a colourful little collection. It's got lots of nice little fables and tales and things like that. So it's very approachable collection. But we don't find a kind of a detailed explanation of the actual meaning of Satipatthana. Some of the variations in the Satipatthana formula I pointed to before, specifically where it talks about developing of samadhi in that context, are found from the Sanyutta context. Now there's one sutta, one or two suttas, which deal with the vipassana aspect of Satipatthana, okay? And so this is the sutta known in the Pali as the Vibhanga, or the Samudaya Sutta. The reason I say and or is because it seems to me that these suttas actually belong together, and the editorial situation is not clear, but it seems to me that these two suttas actually belong together, which they are found more or less in the Chinese version, and that they also served as the source material for the specifically vipassana aspects, or some of the specifically vipassana aspects which we find in the Satipatthana Sutta and the Majjhima. Okay, so this is the source material for those ideas in the Satipatthana Sutta, where especially talking about contemplating of the origination and dissolution and things like that. Okay, and so this is where we find those things in the Sanyutta. Again, without going into all of the textual details with that, it's a bit problematic. But essentially, what the Vibhanga Sutta does is it tells us what is the origin of these things. Okay, so it says what is the origination of the body. Okay, so as soon as we hear the word samudaya, right, we know this is vipassana. Okay, it's talking about causality. Right. What is the origination of the body? The body is originated by food. Okay? It's fairly straightforward. Right? So this is, again, it's a condition, and we've seen that the four foods are part of the dependent origination. Feeling is conditioned by?
Contact.
Right. Again, dependent origination. We pass in a context. Chitta is conditioned by?
Name and form.
Yeah? Which is quite interesting. Why name and form?
You put namas on the rupas, and then that kind of feeds your mind in a way.
Right.
Because when you're born, what feeds the mind is what you experience.
Right.
And so nama rupa is kind of like seeing that form and making an association with that form.
Yep.
Or the smell, the taste, yep. The touch. And that kind of feeds the mind. Without that kind of thing going on, you can't really make much sense in the world.
Yep. So why, and that's the same as the nama rupa and vijnana in the context of dependent origination. So why does it use vijnana in dependent origination and citta in satipatthana?
Because you develop the mind to concentration.
Citta bhavana. Right. Yeah. That's what I think the answer is. So I think I've mentioned this before. Different words for mind in the Pali, you have three different words for mind: citta, mano, and vijnana. Okay, now they basically mean the same kind of thing, right? But they tend to be used in different contexts. Citta tends to be used in the context of the fourth noble truth, development of the mind. Okay, specifically samadhi. Citta bhavana is a synonym for samadhi bhavana. Mano tends to be used in the context of the second noble truth, okay? So mano is the active force, the originator, okay? So the kamma is made by the mano, typically. Vijnana is typically used in the context of the first noble truth, dukkha, okay? The five khandhas, dependent origination, the six sense bases, okay? All of them use vijnana for the mind. It's not hard and fast, but that tends to be the usage. So what we seem to have here is a context where when this relationship between vijnana and nama rupa is expressed in its native environment, which is dependent origination, okay, then we use vijnana and nama rupa, which is the same terminology that's found in the Upanishads. When it's then taken out of that native environment and applied in the context of Satipatthana, we then find citta and nama rupa, okay, where citta is originally chosen because it expresses that idea of development of the mind, okay? So the development of the mind leading to samadhi, okay? Typically used in the context of the path. And now that path context is now being used from a vipassana angle, okay? And so we're taking that out of its native context or its basic context and we're using it, looking at it from another direction, okay? So in other words, this is like, if you like, an advanced teaching or an advanced practice, okay, looking at it from a new angle, okay, or from a more profound angle, rather than simply developing the mind, we're now looking at what are the roots of the mind, okay. There are similar kinds of things found elsewhere in the suttas, where, say, in the context of the five spiritual faculties, where you move from a thing of developing samadhi to a thing of of actually understanding it. Okay, and so this is my feeling is what's going on here, is when it's giving these particular teachings, which I think originally is one sutta, okay, one out of 70 suttas, okay, and so now after we've been taught the basic teachings on Satipatthana and how that fits in with the samadhi aspects of the path and so on and so forth, we then have one sutta out of the 72, which then shows, well, there's another aspect of it as well. You can also see it in a vipassana context.
So I don't understand what's meant by citta is derived from nama rupa and name and form. Is it suggesting that when the baby's born, it's given a name, then it turns mind?
Okay. You don't get it, okay. Well, it's a bit complicated. I think Venerable's explanation is quite good, but... you should have come to... I did 6 months of teachings on dependent origination last year, so we can revisit those. it's a difficult question. Enough to know that in this context that it is related to that context in dependent origination. Okay. Then in the dhammas, the last one of the four, so body, feelings, mind, and dhammas. The last one, dhammas, it says the origination of dhammas is manasikara. Manasikara, the attention. Attention. So again, that's very interesting. Now, and this raises the question, of course, what does dhammas mean, which we'll have a look at in a little while, but generally speaking, that teaching on manasikara is very common, especially in the Bhojanga Sanyutta, where it says, wrong attention gives rise to the five hindrances, and right attention gives rise to the seven enlightenment factors, awakening factors, seven bhojangas. And in the different versions of the Satipatthana Sutta, okay, one of the things we find here is it doesn't come across too well in the display here, but you can see that I've sort of put a slight grey background on the common factors. Okay, so the grey ones are common between all of the different versions. So in the context of the dhammas, the common factors are the five hindrances and the seven enlightenment factors, or seven awakening factors. The other ones, they come and go, or they'll be in different places or whatever, but those ones are constant. And that makes perfect sense, doesn't it? Yeah, we're told in, there's, I don't know how many suttas, 20 or so suttas in the Bhojanga Sanyutta, which say that it's the right attention gives rise to the enlightenment factors, wrong attention gives rise to the hindrances, and then we see these hindrances and awakening factors. And if we didn't think that that was the actual reason, the commentary explicitly tells us that that's the case. The commentary says that that's what it means in this context, and it doesn't try to. So how do we explain that attention gives rise to the five aggregates, or to the seven, to the six sense bases, okay? There's nowhere in the suttas where it says that attention gives rise to the five aggregates or anything like that. It's quite contrary to the normal sutta's position on causality of these things. So it seems to me very clear that the original content of contemplation of dhammas was the five hindrances and seven awakening factors. Okay. You know, when we're going through this, you know, notice that there's different degrees of certainty with which we can say things, yeah? And some things we can just speculate and we can't really find the answer. Other things we can be fairly confident of. And this particular finding, I think, we can be virtually certain that this is actually the original meaning of dhammas here, is it should be the hindrances and awakening factors. Okay? And after some discussion with Venerable Anali of this one, I managed to convince him of the reasonableness of my position. It should have been obvious from the beginning, but... especially when you see the commentarial explanation. Okay? So the conclusion... here's the Samudaya Sutta, the origination. So you find what you hear... So this is the actual Samudaya Sutta. I've translated it from the Chinese version because it seems to me the Pali version is very incoherent and has lots of very obvious textual problems, okay? And I think that's the result of the editing, where things were almost literally cut and pasted out of it and left behind in a quite incoherent form. But in the Chinese version, it actually makes much more sense. In the Chinese translation, I'll teach you the origination and dissolution of the four satipatthanas. Listen, pay attention. What's that? Due to the origination of food, there's the origination of the body. Due to the cessation of food, there's the dissolution of the body. In this way, a monk, or nun, contemplates the nature of origination in the body, contemplates the nature of dissolution in the body, contemplates the nature of origination and dissolution in the body. He abides independent, not grasping at anything in the world. So, of course, from our reading of the Theravada Satipatthana Sutta, we're quite familiar with these last phrases. And okay, these particular phrases are repeated at the end of every meditation exercise in the Satipatthana Sutta, in the Theravada version. Okay, it's the basic, what we call that, the refrain, okay, each time. Okay, and the origination of contact, the origination of feelings, and then contemplates the origination of dissolution and feelings. In the name and form, there's the mind. Contemplates origination and dissolution in the mind, and the origination of dhammas. Contemplates the nature of origination in the dhammas. Okay? So, this particular Chinese version makes a very strong connection between this sutta and the Vipassana refrain of the Theravada Satipatthana Sutta. And it allows us, once we've made that connection, to then get a better idea of the shift in emphasis, okay, the way that we can be programmed by the shift in emphasis. The same thing, right? It's the same teaching found in one sutta out of 72 suttas in the Samyutta. That same teaching found once in the 72 suttas is then repeated 25, 26, 27 times or something, can't remember exactly how many times, in the Satipatthana Sutta after every meditation exercise, okay? So having it once, gone from being one out of 70 suttas to being 25 times in one sutta. Okay? That's how radical that shift in emphasis is. Okay? And of course that creates a massive difference in how you see it. Okay? If you recite and go through the Satipatthana Sutta, it's being drummed into your head, contemplating origination factors, contemplating dissolution factors, contemplating origination and dissolution factors. Okay? So this is Vipassana approach, being hammered into your head again and again and again. And that could have been nothing more than a redactor's decision. Okay? It's an editor's decision. Oh, we want to have this. There is this aspect of Vipassana in Satipatthana. We want to include that in the Majjhima so the Majjhima reciters can also have access to that. So we'll put it in here. Where should we put it in? Oh, let's put it in at the end of every meditation exercise. Okay? And so it's put in there, and so it creates an overwhelming impression of the importance of impermanence and causality within the context of Satipatthana.
Bhante, don't you think it could be the other way around, which is that it's in the actual direct experience of awareness and noticing, being present for the breath. See, there's two different minds, okay? Mm-hmm. One mind, you notice the breath, the mind becomes concentrated and unified and you go into samadhi.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's another mind which notices more, just naturally.
Mm-hmm.
But it's the mind that's noticing the arising and passing, because you look at you're noticing the breath, you're present, and that's what mindfulness does. It's not like you're imposing, it's just that some minds notice as you're watching,
mm-hmm.
go into arising and passing. And so it's like, depending on your mind, you go into those two different streams, at least until stream entry. So that it could have been, what you're talking about, could have been from practice that came, that it was reflected then in the suttas, that particular emphasis.
Yeah.
This.
I mean, it could have been. So you can never kind of rule out any particular idea. But, you know, all I can say is that, you know, I'm building up this picture piece by piece. And it's not arbitrary. I'm not reading these things arbitrarily into it. So I'm going through systematically, one piece by one piece, and showing that everything we're talking about is coming from that sort of emphasizing that samatha aspect, okay? And even if that is the case, so fine, very happy to accept that there is, you know, the samatha and vipassana aspects of it, and fine, of course, different meditators will contemplate them in different ways, yeah? And even if that was the case, that you're saying is the case, right, then still that leaves the overwhelming shift in emphasis, okay? It's not a problem if then that is treated as one sutta out of 70 or 75 suttas on Satipatthana, and we look at it in that context. The problem is when that sutta and that sutta alone is taken up and represented as being definitive on Satipatthana, and all the rest are ignored, which is effectively what's happened, okay? And so that's when it can tend to be misread. So again, it's not a problem in terms of, yes, of course, people do have those different aspects in their meditation, and it may or may not be right for one person to practice in that way, yeah? So that's not the issue. The issue is like the reification of a particular text, probably as a result of the redaction process and the doctrinal developments within Theravada, rather than... it's very difficult with the argument from meditation experience. It's very difficult because it doesn't leave traces in the same way. So I can find textual traces in the suttas, okay, and I can learn something about the redaction process from that. But it's very difficult to find those kinds of things which you're mentioning. Which is not to say that...
Because I didn't want to interrupt all the time, just something in my voice, because Anadia does quote textual support for looking at impermanence. You know, I mean, it's just like I wish I was a scholar, you know, because I can only talk from my own practice. But there are scholars who are quoting textual support for that.
Yeah, I mean, at another time maybe, yeah. If you want, I can go through and refute them all one by one.
Oh, really?
It's okay. Not that difficult.
Okay.
Okay? But it just takes too long. Quite happy to take up the challenge. That's also a feature of knowledge and scientific knowledge generally, and that is that any position which has been accepted by as orthodox then accumulates a vast weight of evidence in its favour. Through a natural process, you see things that way, so you accumulate evidence which seems to support that point of view, but which is in fact just based on assuming that point of view. And that happens not just in Buddhism, but it happens a recognized thing in science as well. And that's why you have this great thing of a paradigm shift, where you say, well, you actually look at it from a completely different point of view, yeah? So, yeah. So that's what I'm asking for, is a paradigm shift. Okay, so again, leaving aside all the details of that, it's a very complicated. Again, I won't go into the relationships here between Satipatthana and Anapanasati. Just to notice briefly that the suttas coordinate the four Satipatthanas and the four sections of breath meditation, Anapanasati. And in that context, it makes it very clear that, of course, the first three tetrads of Anapanasati are primarily samatha practices, breathing, tranquilizing the body and so on, experiencing rapture and bliss and so on, gladdening the mind, putting the mind into samadhi and releasing the mind, okay? So this is anapanasati, and this correlates generally with the first three aspects of satipatthana, contemplation of the body, feelings, mind and dhammas, okay? And the last tetrad of anapanasati starts out anicca anupassi, contemplating impermanence. Okay, contemplating fading vastra rotation relief. So this suggests that it's in this fourth satipatthana, contemplation of dhammas, that the native home of vipassana is found. Okay, this is the suggestion. Okay, so if we can correlate that, so the first three satipatthanas primarily is about finding samadhi and concentrating the mind. The contemplation of dhammas moves on to the vipassana aspect. And in particular, the vipassana aspects within the overall context of the meditation itself. So one's breathing in, breathing out, one contemplates impermanence. So it's not a general contemplation of impermanence, but specifically within that contemplation of the breath. Okay? So this is the suggestion from this context, and we can see how that looks in the overall context of Satipatthana.
The way I understand that is that with the first three, so you kind of, it leads up to samadhi, you go into samadhi after you come in after samadhi, then you do this.
Contemplation of dhammas?
Right.
Yeah.
It seems that, you know, all those factors there, up until number 13,
yeah,
all kind of samadhi practice.
Yep.
And then so they have number 11.
Yep.
Yeah, so in the mind in samadhi.
Yep.
So that means probably jhanas. So
yep.
After you come out of jhana, then you do the kind of practice.
Yep, absolutely.
Of your permanence, because your mind is purified.
It didn't say directly jhana when it talks about samadhi and that.
But samadhi is defined as.
Yeah.
I mean, samadhi has samadhi general definitions all through the sutras. It doesn't just mean jhana.
I would dispute that.
Okay, another discussion.
Yeah, I mean, have a look in Swift Pair of Messengers. I've been through every context in the suttas that talks about samadhi. The basic thing is that in every significant doctrinal definition of samadhi, it always defines it as the four jhanas. There's no exceptions to that. In other places where it's talking more generally, it doesn't define it as the four jhanas. But in those contexts, it's either not serious samadhi, like it's not saying this leads to enlightenment or anything like that, or it's talking about post-jhanic practices. Okay, there are, you know, just, I mean, I just can say this, but there aren't any exceptions to that in the Pali Canon, because I've looked at all of the contexts.
Should I quote something?
No, keep on going, because it's going to take too long.
I mean, I did follow up some of the stuff you said in some of the Nikayas, but I didn't write it down.
No.
But when the Buddha was talking about Samadhi and Sanyutta in some instances, it just seemed like general meditation. It really didn't... In looking at it, it really didn't seem like it was talking about jhanas. It was just talking about the mind being concentrated as against being in jhana.
Again, just to bear in mind that distinction between ordinary language concepts, context where you're just talking about stuff generally, and then the specific, like what I mentioned before, the nidata context, where it's presenting something explicitly and clearly, and in a definitive sense as a factor of the path. So in those explicit, clear, definitive things where it says, what is right samadhi of the Eightfold Path? It's the four jhanas. What is this factor, the samadhi faculty? Four jhanas. What is the power of samadhi? It's the four jhanas. What is the awakening factor of samadhi? It's the four jhanas. What is samadhi in the gradual training? It's the four jhanas. Again and again and again. In the sila samadhi panya, what is the four jhanas? What is samadhi? It's the four jhanas. So in all of those definitive and straightforward contexts, it's always saying samadhi is the four jhanas. So if in a couple of poems or occasional contexts or dubious passages or whatever it uses it in a different way, you don't upturn your mainstream, clearly established understanding in order to cater for these obscure little bits and pieces over here. Okay, it's just that there is a certain looseness in the way that the language is used. It doesn't change what it means in those central contexts as well. Yeah. Again, I mean, I know I sound like I'm just asserting these things, but I have spent 10 years studying this stuff, so I know that there just aren't any context. And so many times these things happen. People always come up, oh, what about XYZ? And I say, well, yeah, here's XYZ on page something something. And they say, well, what about this one? I say, well, yeah, here it is on... I've just looked at them all. And there's none of them that can actually be used to establish those conclusions. Yeah? So...
So then let me, you know... I guess what I'm holding is the experience. You know, what you're doing is presenting a particular perspective based on your understanding of the suttas. Much of it, like, sounds right on. And then, you know, the experience of a movement, a personal movement, of at least coming to stream entry without jhanas. I mean, that's something that's happening.
Well, you just need to put that aside, that's all. So you can't, you know, if you want to re-examine your understanding, you just have to put those things to one side, that's all.
No. I mean, I'm quite willing to re-examine understanding, but it's just, what does it mean to have all these experiences in the Buddhist world happening?
Yeah.
You know, which is freeing, but not reflected in the early, in your textual understanding. All I'm saying is that you've got something very...
Of course, raised a lot of questions, yeah.
Yeah.
And that's That's something I think that the Buddhist tradition needs to look at. You know? I mean, it's too complex to go into everything. But again, just to, you know, specifically look at that, what the textual basis is first, and then the meanings and implications of that, I think, will take time. I don't make any assumptions about that.
We have to ask ourselves when people say they're stream entrants, are they really stream entrants, and why are they saying that they are?
Yeah. Okay, so that's just the Sanyutta, very briefly, okay? So, having now attempted a partial and brief, incomplete look at the first paragraph of the Satipatthana Sutta, it's now taken us 3.5 hours. Think about it, guys. Okay? We now look at the actual thing. Now, when we look at the Satipatthana Sutta, of course, we've looked at the building blocks, the things that it's made out of, the bricks from which it's constructed. When we look at the final form, we have, of course, the 7 or 8 versions, depending on how you want to count them. Here I've counted the Theravada Satipatthana Sutra as just one version. Of course, we've got the Majjhima version and the Digha version. Structurally, they're the same, although this has more content in the Digha version, as we've heard before. So that's one version. Now, in addition to this, we've got another 6 versions, which I'll briefly survey, and then go on to look at each one of them in not too much detail, but just a little bit of detail. First one is the Vibhanga. Now, the Vibhanga I've already referred to is an Abhidhamma text. And this particular Abhidhamma text it basically just gives a series of quotes from the suttas, most of which are the basic suttas from the Sanyutta Nikaya, okay, on the basic topics of the Sanyutta. So it'll give, starts out with the 5 khandhas and gives a basic passage on the 5 khandhas, and then gives an elaborate Abhidhamma description and analysis of that, and then goes to the 6 sense bases and dependent origination, 4 noble truths, 4 elements, and so on and so forth. And one of the chapters is dealing with Satipatthana. And so in that chapter on Satipatthana, we find what appears to be a quote or, you know, cut-and-pasted version, almost, of the Satipatthana Sutta. So this is one of our sources. So this is one of the things that I found when I was doing this research, is that not only do we have the Sutta material, which everyone focuses on, but we also have Abhidhamma material as well. And this is that phenomenon of intratextuality, where stuff can be cut and pasted from the suttas, put into the Abhidhamma. Of course, the Abhidhamma text as a whole dates from a later period, but that tells us nothing about the date of the individual units upon which that is constructed. And as I said, most of the time in this particular work, the basic statements at the start of the chapter is simply quoted directly from the suttas. Okay, it's just cut and paste from the suttas. Okay, now, having seen that one, then comparative studies on the Abhidhammas, especially done by a fellow called Frauhalner, who is a German scholar, have his book down there on the comparative study of the different Abhidhammas, the different traditions. You're most welcome to browse through it for a bit of afternoon's light entertainment. And he noticed, and it had been previously noticed by others, but he basically proved that these 3 Abhidhamma works, all from different schools, are based on the same original Abhidhamma text. And that's proved not merely because of the generic similarity in them, but also because of certain particular peculiarities which are found in these texts and not in any others. Okay? So there's no doubt that these 3 texts, although all of them in their final form as we have them now are quite different, but they clearly hark back to an early Abhidhamma recension, which is probably the first Abhidhamma text. And so this gives us an idea what the first Abhidhamma was, or at least part of the first Abhidhamma, was simply collect the sutta quotes from the main chapters in the Sanyutta Nikaya, and then the basic topics of 5 khandhas, 6 sense bases, dependent origination, and so on, and give an explanation of each one of those. Okay, and that makes perfect sense. That's the kind of thing which would be very useful, yeah, to understand the Dhamma, you know, rather than having all of these topics scattered all over the place. You know, we want to know five khandhas, we want to be able to open up one place and have a look at it and get an understanding. So that's what this book did, book or text or whatever. It wasn't written, it was still an oral text. One version of it is called the Dharma Skanda. This is Sarvastivadin Abhidharma, again regarded as foundational by the Sarvastivadin Abhidharma school and existing in Chinese translation and also partially in a Sanskrit text, although the bits that we're interested in don't exist in Sanskrit as far as I'm aware. The third one is the Shariputra Abhidharma, which is a Dharmaguptaka text, Abhidharma text, found again in Chinese translation. So both of these found in Chinese translation and belonging to some of the other early important schools. Okay, and each of them has a chapter on Satipatthana. Okay, so that's the Abhidharma sources. So this is one of the kind of the innovations which I've done in here, which not many other scholars have done. In fact, I don't know anyone really who's done it. So for example, we've been reading through Venerable Anālaya's comparative studies on the suttas, and he sticks pretty much to the sutta material. And here, because I've noted that the Abhidhamma material is cut and pasted from the suttas, so I've treated it on a comparative basis. Now, as well as that, then we have three sutta versions, of course the Pali, and as usual, the Sarvastivadin Smrityubhasthana Sutra. I really love reading these names in Sanskrit, it's great fun. And this is, again, from our Majjhima Agama. We're very familiar with from reading the suttas in Venerable Anālaya's studies. That, of course, most of them have parallels there. What I'm calling the Ekayana Sutra, the title's actually a bit... It's just to distinguish it, it's not entirely clear. But this is from the Ekotara Agama, possibly Mahasangika school. For this book, I've kind of assumed that it's likely to be Mahasangika. It's not certain. So this is another version. So these two from the Chinese Agamas. And finally, another one I just kind of noticed at random is that actually in the Prajnaparamita Sutra, of course being the foundational Mahayana Sutras, if not the foundational Mahayana Sutra, actually has one of the chapters where it quotes, again, more or less cut and paste from a version of the Satipatthana Sutta. And unfortunately, it only gives the first Satipatthana in detail. And for the remaining ones, the feelings, mind and dhammas, it just gives this short formula, which is a bit unfortunate. It just abbreviates. Prajnaparamita literature is vast and extremely complex. There's many translations in Chinese, many in Tibetan, and vast amounts of Sanskrit fragments and things. So it could well be the case that there are versions to be found which actually fill this out, which would be great to find, although I did check through quite a few of the Chinese versions, and they seem to be quite consistent in omitting this thing here. Well, it's by no means thorough.
Why would losing orifices have such importance?
Well, you know, this is a rendering which I, you might imagine, I kind of delighted in putting this. I thought it might wake people. Sort of few people might wake up when they're kind of reading this.
In the Prajnaparamita version, doesn't it say?
It's like, well, you know, the fluids that kind of flow out of the body, you know?
I know what it is.
Yeah. It's one of the contemplations. Yeah.
But it's one of many corpse things.
This isn't corpses, this is live bodies.
Live body? Losing orifices?
That's
in a charnel ground.
No, no, no. Charnel ground's a separate one. This is a list. Oozing orifices.
Well, when would oozing orifices happen?
When Sangeet's infected.
When Sangeet's infected, perhaps?
Yeah.
When what?
Well, you've got these holes in the body, you know, every hole in your body you've got, and it kind of leaks out fluids all the time.
Just before you eat, you start to salivate?
Saliva and tears and snot and everything else.
I guess when your ears start doing it, you're in trouble.
Yeah, that's true.
Isn't that the case in the Prajnaparamita version? It says, instead of a bhikkhu, it says a bodhisattva.
That's right. Yep. So I just switches the terms. Ripped it off. One way of putting it.
Has it using orifices as well? Or?
No.
No,
they're too pure for that.
They have four parts of the body as they.
Okay, so just to have a look briefly at each of these different versions, okay? The reason I started out in this book, again, it's a bit unconventional, but I started out with the Abhidhamma texts, in partly was to deconstruct our expectations. Okay, I wanted to deal with as much material as I could before turning around to the Pali version of the Satipatthana Sutta. So I started out with discussing the Abhidhamma versions to try to leverage our expectations away from what we think it's going to be. Now, notice that. Now, normally, of course, what's the when you think Abhidhamma, you think long-winded, lots of repetitions, and very expansive, and you put everything in there. But here, the Abhidhamma version is very short, and it's very unusual. In fact, almost unique in the Abhidhamma to really abbreviate things. Actually, the shortest of them all. Not only in the body contemplation, it only has the parts of the body. So this is one thing. Secondly, that particular practice is the only practice which is actually found in every one of the versions. Okay, it's a practice of the parts of the body. Okay, it's the elements, the six elements or four elements, is found in most versions. Okay, here four elements. So found in almost all versions. Charnel ground practices, again, is found in several versions. Okay, so, they're not entirely disparate. They're not completely different kinds of things, but still, it remains the fact that the parts of the body is the only one that's in every version and alone in the Vibhanga. Now, there are a couple of other features of the Vibhanga which are also interesting. One is that the body is just the 31 parts of the body. Yeah? So, just not the 32 parts of the body which you find in later texts. So, even though in the later part of the Pali Canon we find the 32 parts of the body, here it's still 31, again suggesting the earliness of it. Another issue here, another
thing that's... What's the change in elements? Why four and six?
It can be either. Suttas will use the six to four elements, of course, earth, wind, fire, water, and then the space and consciousness. Yeah. Typically, what you find here, like this one here, the Dharmaskandha, is a Sarvastivadin text, and so is this one version of the Smrityupasthana Sutra. Also is a Sarvastivadin, and so they have the six elements, and that's standard in the Sarvastivadin text that they almost always have the six elements rather than four.
Could that be a cultural thing, Bhante? In that area of the world, they believe in the six elements as a normal part of their animistic or shamanistic sort of rites and rituals?
Not sure. Probably has some implications, philosophical implications, in the development of the Sarvastivadin teaching. It might have been a local variant. The space element is emphasized in the Brahmanical, in the Upanishads as well.
Maybe because they can define space as existing in the past, present, and future.
Yeah. In any case, so that's that. Now notice also that in the Vibhanga, the section on feelings is similar, again, common with all the others, and if anything, simpler than the other versions. Similarly with the contemplation of mind, either in common with all the others, and in some cases simpler, has things that are on the others. And the same thing with the contemplation of dhammas, that again we only have the five hindrances and seven awakening factors, which are the common factors in the contemplation of dhammas. Everything else adds something, and this is the only one that has just those two. And also, in the refrain, it just has the contemplation internally and externally. It doesn't have the contemplation of rise and fall and all the other things which we find in the different versions. So in every respect, every category that we look at, it's looking simpler and more straightforward than all the others. Okay?
Does that seem to indicate an older, usually an older source, because everybody loves to put their little...
Put the little bits and spins in, yeah. So it seems to indicate that this is an older source. In fact, perhaps the oldest source.
Early Abhidhamma texts.
Early Abhidhamma texts, yeah. And there are also other internal suggestions of the same thing. You remember in the Satipatthana Sutta, if you look at page... we're going here. For example, page 151, the contemplation of the five hindrances. 151, it says, and how bhikkhus does a bhikkhu abide contemplating mind objects and mind objects as mind objects? Okay, mind objects meaning dhammas here. Here, bhikkhu abides contemplating dhammas as dhammas in terms of the five hindrances. And how does a bhikkhu abide contemplating dhammas as dhammas in terms of the five hindrances? And then it goes on to describe the practice. And then at the end it says, and this is how blah, 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 blah. And that right at the end, on the end of paragraph 37 on page 152, it says, and that is how a bhikkhu abides contemplating dhammas as dhammas in terms of the five hindrances. Okay? Now, those taglines are not in this Abhidhamma Vibhanga. Okay? It just gives the bare practice and doesn't say what you're doing. And again, this is a sign of being textually early, that it's just giving you the primitive chunk of describing the practice. And it's not, it's a bit like you've got a book with like the contents pages and the notes. It's all the furniture which goes around it. You know, somebody's gone and they put an index in the back and they've done nice numbering on the paragraphs. It's all the stuff which is guiding you through the text rather than being the meat of the content of it. And so again, this is another suggestion. All of these things are adding up quite consistently to a suggestion that what we've got here with the Vibhanga is probably an early, perhaps the earliest form of the actual Satipatthana Sutta.
So that means we can extract it from the Vibhanga?
Well, that's effectively what I've done, yeah. When I presented the source, I basically relied mainly on the Vibhanga. Yeah. Why is that so? Why is the Abhidhamma version so consistently simpler and more straightforward than the Sutta version?
I guess it was simple at one stage, and when they started to develop this idea of, you know, bringing everything together in the Abhidhamma, and they did that, but then the Abhidhamma reciters and the Sutta reciters are different, and so the Sutta reciters changed the Satipatthana Sutta. The Abhidhammas may not know about it, may not have direct contact with them, and thus the change they're not aware of, but they keep their lineage going and they keep their lineage going, and so it doesn't match up in the end.
So that's part of the thing, is like a separation of lineages, recitation lineages within the tradition, you know, maybe reflect perhaps different monasteries, you know, maybe one monastery you've got the Abhidhamma teacher and they're kind of developing this and somewhere else. So that's one thing. Another thing is that in a sense, they both develop things in their own way. The sutta is developed more internally by putting things within the same context and presenting them as part of the same original sutta. The Abhidhamma is developed externally. The sutta is just plonked there, and then the other stuff is developed afterwards. So it's very easy to distinguish the two, okay? So when you look at the text, you can obviously say, well, here it's going into the whole Abhidhamma analysis bit. And so what I've done is simply extract the sutta parts, and so it's very obvious that this is what it's done. So in a sense, you could say that actually both of them have been developed, but because of the literary style of the Abhidhamma, because of this separation of the textual traditions that we're talking about, the literary style of the Abhidhamma, the original thing remains more core, and then the other one is developed more in a more internal thing. Well, kind of a simile I thought of.
Of other
things.
Not just with the Satipatthana Sutta, but with other aspects.
I've had a bit of a look through that. In the Pali, the only one where there seems to be a significant one is the teaching on the gradual training, which is given very simply in the Abhidhamma Vibhanga. So that may also be a similar case. I'm not sure with the other Abhidhamma texts. I haven't looked through them in such detail, but certainly it's possible that there could be other examples of that. So the kind of the simile that springs to my mind, you know, your similes are shaped by your experience, is comparing two houses which are being renovated. Okay, so one house, the people move into it, and they move maybe in at the same time. They're both houses, 20-year-old houses, they're being renovated. People move in and they want to renovate them. One lot of renovators thinks, we're going to paint, we're going to change the woodwork here, we're going to fix the floor up, we're going to do all of these things. So they're changing the existing structure. Another group of people think, we need an extension out the back for the kids. Okay, so they leave the existing structure as it is and build more extensions on the back. Yeah? So they're both putting the same amount of work in and changing things to the same degree, but they're changing them in different ways. If you wanted to come along and tell what did the house look like originally, you're actually much better with the guys who have built an extension out the back, okay? Because they've left all the internal more or less as it was, okay? So that's maybe like what kind of difference that we've got here, okay? So one of the aspects of this version in the Vibhanga is it doesn't have what we call the vipassana refrain, the contemplation of rise and fall. So we can see here that the contemplation of rise and fall is found in some versions and not in others. About half of the versions. Three out of seven. Not found in the Vibhanga version. And perhaps again that represents an early tendency that the emphasis on vipassana was growing as the text grew, and the early version doesn't have that emphasis. But that also, if we take this as being indicative of that, then we can look at how, as I mentioned before, in the context of anapanasati, how the vipassana aspect of satipatthana emerges, especially in this contemplation of dhammas, the five hindrances and seven enlightenment factors. Okay, and then that's found in this version. I've got three versions of the file open here. Okay, here. Now this is just by way of comparison. Okay, so the contemplation of mind, again, is presented fairly consistently in all the versions. Okay, contemplation of dhammas. Again, this particular phrasing is consistent through all the versions. So what is the difference? One contemplates mind with lust, saragam chittam, as mind with lust, saragam chittam tipajanati. One understands mind without lust, vitaragam chittam, as mind without lust, vitaragam chittam tipajanati. Okay? So that's a typical phrasing that we have in the contemplation of mind, similar to the contemplation of feelings in other places in Satipatthana Sutta. Contemplation of dhammas, we have this kind of phrasing. Santang wa ajhatang kama chandang, atime ajhatang kama chando tipajanati. Okay? Asantang wa ajhatang kama chandang, natime ajhatang kama chando tipajanati. Yanchita dubayam, yathacha anupanasa, kama chandasa upado hoti, tanchipajanati. Yathacha upanasa kama chandasa pahanang hoti, tanchipajanati. Yathacha pahinasa kama chandasa. So, as well as those two initial clauses, which are similar to the contemplation of mind, you also have these extra three clauses. And it's in these extra three clauses that you have the notion of causality. You're understanding how these things arise. So you're not just aware, is this here or is it not? Okay? But you're understanding the causality. Why is it there? What's going on? Yeah? And so this again is moving into that vipassana dimension. Of course, you know, you're building on, it's not separate from what you've been doing before, okay? You're building on the kind of awareness you had before, but it's being extended and deepened, okay? And moving into that more specific understanding of rise and fall, okay? Which is what vipassana is. And so this again, I think, illustrates conditionality, yeah. Absolutely, yeah. So this is again, I think, suggestive or indicative of how in this contemplation of dhammas we're moving into the vipassana side. So again, not separating it from the samatha side, but drawing on it and deepening it, so that all the contemplation we've done before now comes to fruit in here. Okay.
In passage, you talked about seeing things as they really are, but instead. And from a better translation is understanding how they've come to be,
yeah,
or how they've come into existence. So that fits quite well there.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you're understanding the cause of it. And again, this is again to do with the manasikara. It's like inquiring into causes. Yeah, why are these things here? Yeah. Now, okay, so that's the Vibhanga.
Why haven't modern Abhidhammas and Vipassana teachers picked up on that?
On what?
On that. That the fact that the Satipatthana Sutta doesn't have what's in the Vibhanga. Maybe they have, yeah.
Yeah, they just tend to ignore these things. Okay. Again, similarities between the Dhammaskanda and the Vibhanga. Again, we've been shown by Frau Wilner that they clearly derive from a common ancestor. And, you know, this is a very similarity. The Dhammaskanda also very simple. It only has the parts of the body in six elements, has some other it's starting to grow a little bit, but you know, has some other similarities. Now this passage here is called the Shortcomings. This is my rendering. We'll come back to. I mean, that's another vipassana aspect, but we'll come back to that in a minute. But just another little textual note here is that in the Pali you have this thing, cultivate, develop and make much of these four Satipatthanas, and then you have this emphatic Abhidhamma phrase, Svatthitang Vavattheti, peculiar to the Abhidhamma, not a sutta idiom at all, makes well defined. And the Chinese version of that has exactly the same phrasing. Okay, and so again, this is that little kind of textual indication to suggest that it's explicitly from the same textual basis. It's not merely a similar kind of text. Okay. Okay, so without going into all of the details here, you have this thing that, oh, I've got my renderings inconsistently. I've got tribulations here and shortcomings in the other one. You know, I should have fixed that up. So the tribulation, I've translated it somewhere. Yeah, it's probably a bit later I've translated it. Anyway, keep on going. So contemplation of mind, here I've just put in different versions of the contemplation. That's not particularly relevant, but these are just different versions from different Sarvasivadin sources. You can see they're not quite consistent, but then fairly similar in different versions. Okay, so here's the Vipassana refrain about the shortcomings or tribulations. Furthermore, the monk, with regard to this internal body, observes and contemplates all their many tribulations. Namely, this body is like a sickness, like a boil, like a dart, troublesome, impermanent, suffering, empty, not self, changing, wearisome, a great entanglement. It is of a nature to be lost and to decay rapidly and incessantly, becoming weak, not enduring. It cannot be relied on or trusted. It is of a nature to change and decay. Okay, so the same repeated, of course, for the other Satipatthanas. Obviously, Vipassana kind of phrase, right? Obviously, indicating a certain kind of emotional relationship with one's body and so on. And similar to, you'll recognize similar to passages found in the Pali with the Khanda Sanyutta and so on. We're seeing, no doubt, related to those. So it is a Vipassana phrase, but also important to notice that it's a totally different kind of Vipassana phrase than the phrase that's found in the Theravada Satipatthana Sanyutta. So it's similar. It's showing that both traditions saw, you could see it in terms of Vipassana, right? But it doesn't give us any evidence that there was any textual, ancient textual basis to that. They could have, they've no doubt just imported this phrase from the Khanda Sanyutta or something like that.
What
is this? This is Sarvasivada. Yeah. Okay. So now, another interesting factor of this particular one, when it defines dhammas, it defines dhammas as the aggregates of perception and sankharas. Okay? Now this is another problem with the traditional interpretations of Satipatthana. When we look at the four Satipatthanas, body, feelings, mind and dhammas, it seems that there's some kind of pattern emerging which is in some way similar to the five khandas, the five aggregates. So the body sort of correlates with the rupa khanda. Feelings obviously correlate with the vedana khanda. Mind seems similar to the vijnana khanda. We've seen it's treated in the same way. And so there was this tendency, and of course the khandas being the primary vipassana framework for the suttas, okay? Being hundreds of suttas teaching, contemplating the khandas as impermanent and so on and so forth. So it seems that there was a tendency among the traditions to correlate the four Satipatthanas with the five aggregates. And this is part of that movement towards emphasizing the Vipassana aspect of it. And the problem is, of course, that dhammas doesn't really, if you take away the rupa, vedana and vijnana, you're left with sanya and sankhara, perception and volition, as being your two khandas which are left. And that they don't, of course, correlate in any meaningful way with what we've got here. I mean, obviously, you've got the six sense bases and things like that. It's obviously not sanya and sankhara, so there's not kind of meaningful correlation. And yet, this kind of correlation is very widespread among the traditions, and this is the earliest version I found of it in the Dharmaskanda. So again, this is showing us that it's a very Abhidhamic tendency to want to take up things from different traditions, from different contexts, and then see how they relate to them. This one's equivalent to this one, that one. And it's a very understandable way of doing things, and it's not always the case that they fit in completely neatly. So sometimes they have to be kind of and sort of to bodge them into place to, again, it's like building, you know, it doesn't quite fit in, you give a few whacks with a hammer and there's no problems. So that's the first, that equation of these things is not found in the suttas, and this is, as far as I'm aware, the earliest place it's found is in the Dhammaskanda. Okay? So you can see that from the Dhammaskanda that the differences can be summarized. They're all additions, there's no subtractions. Okay? Compared the Dhammaskanda compared with the Vibhanga. The additional additions are often incongruous, like the setting and various kinds of things which I've talked about before. And sometimes they hint at sectarian tendencies, like there's an influence of talking about the past, present and future, which is characteristic of the Sarvasivadin school. And so if we were to look at those differences between the Vibhanga and Dharmaskanda, even though they're very similar, but all of those differences, again, quite consistently, are suggesting the Dharmaskanda is, if anything, a bit later in its composition than the Vibhanga. Okay? So is there right anything on that particular?
Has that got anything to do with Sariputta, that name?
Yes, it's his name. He's obviously regarded as the author of it. Or, you know, it's in his school or his tradition, Sariputra Abhidharma. So this is the Dharmaguptaka text. Of course, Sariputra being closely associated with the Abhidharma in all the schools. And so, you know, presumably that school maybe had a tradition that it was composed by Sariputra or was in his school, yeah? His lineage. So this is the Dharmaguptaka text. And Dharmaguptaka being a school which is very similar to the Theravadin school, in fact, virtually identical for all practical purposes. And this, in conformity with that, then we can see that this particular version of the Satipatthana Sutta is very similar to the Pali, even though you can't read it, the things there. But if you compare this one with the Pali, Satipatthana Sutta, we can see that they're actually quite similar. Okay, in terms of what they include and what they don't include. In the okay, so I'm just coming to the discussion of itself. I'm doing that. So, under the contemplation of the body, have contemplation of the postures, movements of the body, breath, meditation, anapanasati, parts of the body, four elements, food, space. Okay, so rather than including space as one of the four elements, it lists it separately. Nine orifices. Okay, so contemplate the nine oozing orifices of the body. Okay. So you can see that it's more developed than the other versions that we've seen. And similarly, the actual structure of it's more developed, again, without going into the thing, but the structure of it's more developed as well. Feelings is similar, mind is similar. Dhammas, we have the five hindrances, sense media, and awakening factors, and the Four Noble Truths. So similar to the Pali, except the aggregates are missing. Five khandhas are missing. Okay. Now this one also has contemplation of the rise and fall and so on. So these are the similar to the Pali. Okay. In the Vipassana aspects. Okay. So I won't go into too much into the details there. But this does raise the question as to a number of questions here that are emerging in the structure of the body contemplation. Now, if as it seems from these two versions, that the original content of body contemplation was just the parts of the body, then where does that leave breath meditation, for example? Okay, well, we're told elsewhere in the suttas that anapana is an equivalent to satipatthana. So its presence there is quite natural and could have been brought in at any time. So in saying that it's not part of the original text, it's not saying that it's not part of Satipatthana, it's just simply saying it wasn't taught in that particular context, that's all. So, but it's natural that it would have been brought in. And then these other ones, which is very interesting, is the four postures and the clear comprehension. Now see that these are brought in several versions, only three out of seven. Okay, have these. Oh no, sorry, 4 out of 7, the Prajnaparamita has it as well. And in this case, the sequence of them is very interesting. We've seen these before in the gradual training, that the contemplation of the postures and the clear comprehension is preliminary to meditation, right? So you do all your kind of mindfulness and that kind of stuff, and so on. And this is helping to prepare you for your meditation, okay? That's fine. And the gradual training is like that dozens and dozens and dozens of times. And in the various versions of the Satipatthana Sutta, the Shariputra Vidharma, in the Dhammaguptaka tradition, the Sarivasivadana Sutra, and the Prajnaparamita Sutra, all present the four postures in the practice of clear comprehension in the same way. That is, leading up to meditation, breath meditation in particular. Okay? And they could well have even been cut and pasted from some version of the gradual training or something like that, where it's presented in precisely that sequence. Okay? The only one that's different is the Theravadan version. So the Pali version, for the only time ever in the whole Buddhist world, as far as I'm aware, the only parallel being the Kayagatasati Sutta, which copies this exactly. Okay, the only place in the whole Buddhist universe, right? Am I wrong?
Do you know what Buddhist universe is, Bhante?
Try refute me. Refute me. Go on.
It's really devoted
students. That's right. Yeah. Presents clear comprehension of the body, contemplation of the movements of the body after breath meditation. Okay, now that doesn't mean anything, does it? Okay, it's just a list of meditation topics. Okay, it's not telling us anything particularly about the relationship between these. Okay, but it conveys an impression. Okay, it conveys an impression that what we have here. Whereas in the gradual training, the impression that's conveyed is of preparatory practices which lead up to doing breath meditation. The confession, the impression that's conveyed here is that we have alternative kinds of meditation techniques. Okay, so here, clearly these are kinds of meditation techniques. Tunnel ground meditation, four elements meditation, parts of the body, anapanasati. They're all alternative meditation techniques. You sit down, cross your legs, watch your mind, and do one or other of those. Okay. And it seems, it's presented as if postures is another one which you can also do. And this is taken very literally, certainly in Thailand, where you have the meditation techniques which have developed specifically about moving your hands and so on. You sort of move your hands as a meditation technique. And the authors of those techniques specifically quote this text as justification for that. And they say that the Buddha taught us in the Satipatthana Sutta that we should develop meditation by moving our bodies, okay? And that's a meditation technique. And so, in my opinion, that impression is conveyed solely by this very peculiar, in fact, unique arrangement. And in fact, clear comprehension and so on are meant as preparations for meditation and not as substitutes for it.
It's like the Eightfold Path. You can start in one place, and it really is a building of all of those eight areas of practice.
Oh, for sure, yeah.
And that's really true of the practice of mindfulness and clear comprehension. You know, you could start with breath meditation, and from building that strength, extend it to your different movements and body postures through the day and continue to build it that way. And you can do it the other way around as well.
Of course, they help each other.
Yeah.
But the problem is, that's not the problem. The problem is when you say you don't have to do these other meditations because moving your body around is good enough by itself. And that's what quite a lot of teachers do actually teach. Okay? There's no need for meditation. Because the Buddha said in the Satipatthana Sutta that just being aware of your postures during your daily activities is good enough, and then that can fulfill all the Satipatthanas and you can get fully enlightened without actually sitting and doing formal meditation. This is what some teachers say.
That's not correct, is it?
They're saying that if you watch... I just want to get clear on this. They're saying if you watch the movement of the body with precise mindfulness, you get to see the arising and falling from the different sensations, and you get to see impermanence, and the mind is released.
Yeah. So that's some meditation teachers in Thailand teach that way. Yeah. So this is where I think it's a problem. Fine. yes, of course, we all need to develop, you know, clear comprehension and so on. And it's no problem. But when it replaces the formal meditation practice, then I think this is a problem.
You know, just a second ago you mentioned about meditation and movement. So it sounded like movement.
Yeah.
Well, I first noticed when Ajahn Brahm's retreat, there was a monk. And when Ajahn Brahm and this monk were together, it was very, very noticeable. That they were doing the same thing. They were standing in front of the picture of Buddha dying.
Mm-hmm.
And they looked like a choreographed pair.
Maybe they were.
That wouldn't ring a bell.
I don't know.
That was just my seeing.
I don't know.
I noticed Bhante Jag and you look of a similar cast.
It's what the monks do if they're doing that thing while they're talking to you. That's it, they're kind of keeping their mindfulness practice going. And it's this kind of dissociated kind of thing you get into. It's like, yeah, hello.
It's like
going to Disneyland and seeing the other one they do is they do the Spock kind of thing. You kind of, yeah,
the Spock one, yeah.
And you kind of do that. So Mahakosananda used to do this technique. And he said, you know, you do this, you're mindful, up and down. And then after a while, it gets tired, and then you do this one. You know, oh, it's impermanent. Oh. It's quite good, I do it. You know, you could develop mindful. Because sometimes if it's raining or something, you can't walk outside. And so you do it. But then they come in, you know, morning meetings and stuff like that, you know, you do the chanting and then everyone comes to see him.
Andy, can we go back? Well, at some point, could we,
mm-hmm.
we talk about, you know, it's sort of like how do the texts support us today in our practice? And with the reality of, you know, I mean, Tipati here and the wisdom of his 20 years can question
many of the senior teachers who are considered awakened in some form or another, and I think that's good that you do, Tipati. And just through one's interactions with these teachers, that there clearly is wisdom and some freedom.
Mm.
And they're teaching Vipassana in the ways that you're critiquing.
Mm.
And everything you said makes a lot of sense to me. Here's a question of a world that needs awakening, techniques and technologies that have developed that are working in the sense that people are seeing more clearly the dukkha and what's needed to end dukkha. And yet, it's not being it's considered more modern or newer practice, and perhaps even deviation from textual studies. But it's working. It's working in the sense of the ending of dukkha, in some form or another. Maybe not arahantship. So then, what I'm getting from what you're saying is then the texts become, the texts are becoming less relevant given how you're framing it, because I'm feeling like the separation. Here's this practice happening, it's being taught to thousands of people, you know, and here are textual scholars like you saying, hey, it's not in the text, we shouldn't be doing it. And there's this like separation. Bhante never said you shouldn't be doing it. He's just opened it up for you to have a look at.
Yeah, you can do what you want, I don't care. Yeah.
Question.
But it has significance. What you're saying has significance in terms of the relationship between the way the texts are being interpreted and a practice that is happening and helpful.
Well, well, maybe we could look at it and say, well, perhaps, perhaps, although the practice has been helpful, there are certain aspects of it which could be better and could be more helpful, and that if teachers of that were to take on board some of the things that I'm suggesting here, perhaps they could take something good and make it even better. For example, there are some people for whom I think it's very inappropriate that they should be doing Vipassana style practices, and they need to be calming and unifying their mind. Another aspect is the exclusive aspect, which is sort of hammered home from the this is the only way kind of school, yeah? Which is, you know, read from the Ekayana Magga, this is the only way, you've got to do our technique and all the other techniques are wrong. I mean, the Samatha people also say this kind of thing, so that's not exclusive to Vipassana people. But I think people would be friendlier, you know, towards it, if they weren't sort of told this is the only way, and, you know, like in some of the schools where you're told you have to do only our technique and you can't do any other techniques and so on and so forth.
I think that's what I'm...
Okay, so next, we look at the sutta versions. First sutta version, the Prajnaparamita. And again, it's from a late sutta. Probably Prajnaparamita is like written 500 years after the Buddha or so. But this section cut and pasted and put in there. Okay, so here, the Bodhisattva dwells with contemplating the body and the body and so on. He's clearly comprehending and mindful after putting away all covetousness and sadness. Okay, so it does not form any discursive thoughts associated with the bodies. It's similar to what we've seen before in the Dantabhumi Sutta, ma kayupasanyutam vitakam vitaketi. He doesn't think thoughts associated with the body. So again, very close to the sutta idiom, and without taking anything as a basis, probably related to the phrase in the Satipatthana Sutta, anisito ca vihariti, one dwells independent. Okay, so that's very similar to the Pali idioms. Okay, and then it gives and notice the quote, just of course using Bodhisattva instead of Bhikkhu. And then gives the body contemplations, very similar descriptions of the body contemplation exercises. It also, elsewhere in the Prajnaparamita Sutra, in a completely different context, it then also gives a version of the passage we mentioned before, the Vibhanga Sutta or the Samudaya Sutta, which I talked about before in the Sanyutta, which is talking about the origination and dissolution and so on, from the Vipassana aspects. So it has both of those things, but they're quite separate. That's not included in the Satipatthana Sutta. Again, providing support for my idea that the original version of the Satipatthana Sutta did not have that section on the origination and dissolution, but that was formed by the later merging of two completely separate textual context, which is what we find most of the places, including here in the Prajnaparamita Sutta. Okay, so any questions on that one before we move on? Okay, so I'm going to the Sarvasivadan Smrityupasthana Sutra. Now we can see this one has a very long section on the body contemplation, especially the four postures, clear comprehension, cutting off of thought, and suppressing of thought. These two ones are similar to what we find in Pali in the Vitakka Santana Sutta. Okay. Then Anapanasati. Again, Anapana is taught for cutting off of thought. Okay. Then we have the four jhana similes. Okay. It doesn't actually mention the formulas for the four jhanas, but the similes for the four jhanas that we find many places in the Pali canon, the lotuses and things like that, they're found there. Then it has the perception of light. Okay, one contemplates light, yeah, which is normally given as the opposite of sloth and torpor. Yeah. Then we have this thing called I translate it very inadequately as the basis of reviewing. In Pali is Pachavekana Nimitta. What this is described as being like after you've emerged from samadhi, you then review the state of mind that you had before, and it's described like just like a man who was standing would review a man who was sitting or lying down. Okay, so it's like some kind of separate afterwards. You come out of the practice and you turn back and look at what was going on. Then you have the parts of the body, six elements, and the charnel ground contemplation. So very peculiar kind of contemplation here. these bits, of course, very similar to most of the other versions, and then all of these more samadhi-orientated, general meditation-orientated ones that don't seem to have very much to do with satipatthana as such. So what seems to be going on is that this has been used as a kind of, you know, bag you can fill up and put all kinds of, as it says in the Satipatthana Sutta, the hill rice and the red rice and the beans and the mung beans and so on, and they're all put in there. And in particular, this first section almost looks like a kind of the course of meditation in general. You know, you first of all, you're practicing with clear awareness of your postures, you sit down to meditate and quieten your thoughts down, develop breath meditation, and then get into jhanas. And the perception of light is associated with often with the development of psychic powers. So perhaps then this is psychic powers after jhana, and then the basis of reviewing is the vipassana investigation into one's samadhi states. So it's almost as if this first section makes quite a coherent little exposition of the whole process of meditation in and of itself, although it doesn't have much organic connection with Satipatthana, the rest of the Satipatthana Sutta.
And the perception of light come about as the result of the jhana practice,
right? Yeah, sure.
Instead of rather being the Visuddhimagga style perception of light as a separate meditation object, rather the mind is bright, malleable, really, and all this sort of things of the mind after coming out of the meditation.
It's used variously, and I think it can mean both of those things, yeah.
Because then that forms the basis of reviewing when the mind is in that sort of state.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Yeah, yeah. So it makes perfect sense, but it's just odd in the context, that's all. So that's the Sarvasivadin version, and you see they've added a couple of, they've sort of proliferated here a bit, distinguishing bodily and mental feelings and things like that not found in the other versions, and a few extra things here in the contemplation of mind as well, basically the same but a little bit more developed. And the contemplation of Dhammas, edition of the Six Sense Bases in there. And no mention of Vipassana here. So here in this version, strong emphasis on the Samadhi aspect and de-emphasis of the Vipassana aspect of Satipatthana. Okay? So that's pretty clear in that particular sutta that that's what's being emphasized. Could be sectarian differences. What I suggest, it's pretty tenuous, but I kind of wonder whether this difference in the Satipatthana Suttas relates to sectarian differences between the Pali and the between the Theravada and Sarvasivadin schools. The basic difference between the two was that the Theravadins wanted to chop time up, right? So the Theravadins want to chop time up so it's very, very short. Boom, 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 lots of mind moments and stuff. And Sarvasivadins also had mind moments, but they kept wanting to stretch things out, okay? So Sarvasivadins more stretchy. Even their mind moments. Pali has three sub-moments in one mind moment, and Sarvasivadins have four sub-moments in one mind moment. Okay, so even mind moments stretched out more, and time is always longer and stretched out more. So that stretching out of time is more symptomatic of a samatha approach, where you have like a continuity of awareness, whereas a vipassana approach is more seeing an analytical or deconstructive aspect of awareness. So they're kind of complementary ways of seeing the world. And perhaps, as my suggestion, is that in the early Sarvasivadin and early Theravadin schools, this wasn't necessarily a schismatic difference. There's no massive, you know, irreconcilable differences, but maybe some slight difference in emphasis here. But whether that's characteristic of the schools as a whole, or whether it's just this particular sutta, is not 100% clear, but this is my suggestion in this particular case. Okay? Blah, blah, blah. Few more tables and so on. Ekayana Sutra from possibly Mahasanghika's, possibly not, don't really know. And here, a little bit slightly eccentric presentation. Parts of the body, four elements, oozing orifices, and channel ground contemplation. Again, fairly short and simple there. Feeling no mixed feelings. Anyway, it's just a little slight variation in the phrasing there. But one difference between this one and all the other ones is that, well, a couple of differences. One is that the refrains vary. All the other ones are consistent. Yeah? At each time, the refrain is the same. Boom, 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 boom. Ekayana, nah, those guys weren't hung up on these kinds of things. They weren't like these kind of rigid, uptight Theravadins. Oh, you've got to get the refrain exactly the same every time. They're like, fine, body contemplation, you say it one way, feelings, yes, another way, whatever, you know, it's cool. And so they, yeah, this is a kind of hippie yoga. So there's no problem. And
yeah, the carnal and not carnal.
Yep. And then the carnal spiritual.
Sensual and not.
This
one. The same or not sensual and non-sensual carnal.
Yeah, they basically are the same, but it's added as an extra thing here in the Sarvasivadin version. And it's, and again, it's a bit superfluous. Yeah, it doesn't add anything to the meaning, but yeah.
Actually, isn't it all covered with that top one, pleasant, painful, and neutral?
Not necessarily, because the carnal spiritual one is quite a meaningful distinction. You can distinguish that.
How is that expressed?
The spiritual feelings, spiritual pleasant feeling, is feelings in the first three jhanas.
Oh, okay.
Painful spiritual feeling is the longing, oh, when am I going to get those liberations which the noble ones abide in?
But isn't it
and the new pain, and the neutral spiritual feeling is the feeling in the fourth jhana.
Isn't it still
feeling the fourth jhana is neutral?
Neutral spiritual feeling. Yeah.
They were still subsumed under all. I mean,
is
it painful and neutral?
They're all subsumed under it. Yeah, but it's just giving a more detailed analysis of it. That's all. Now. One of the interesting differences here with the old Ekayana version is that it doesn't have the five hindrances at the in the Dhamma, contemplation of Dhammas. Contemplation of Dhammas just has the seven awakening factors and the four jhanas. It's obviously a strong samadhi emphasis here. But the five hindrances are in introduction and in the conclusion, but not in the Dhammas section. So my feeling with this particular one is that it actually says in the introduction, if you remember we talked about this before, it actually says, why is it called the Ekayana, the one way? Because it leads to one-pointedness of mind. Okay, and so it seems to me that this particular version is emphasizing the Samatha aspect quite strongly. And so it's defined the one way as being the Samadhi, and then it emphasizes that by repeating both in the introduction and in the conclusion that the purpose of the practice is to abandon the five hindrances. And replacing the negative expression in the Dhammas section is to say abandoning the five hindrances. The positive expression of that is to say to get the four jhanas. Okay, so it seems to me this is the redaction that was already there. So this I'm talking about the changes which they made. So they cut this out, hindrances out, put it in the beginning and the end, and the four jhanas is like the positive side of it. Yeah. So this is my feeling about how this developed. So this has the rise and fall refrain sometimes, and so on and so forth. So
what's the ideology with putting? I've seen it in the sutra from the refrain. They always have this refrain, or mm-hmm. You mix it with refrain or insight.
Mm-hmm. The insight refrain.
What are they?
Refrain just means a repeated section.
Okay.
So at the end of each meditation exercise, at the end of each one of these, generally speaking, they have the refrain is repeated. Okay, and in the Pali version, that refrain is the insight section. Okay, or part of that refrain is the insight section.
From my memory, in the Digha Nikaya by Walsh, the first two refrains are exactly the same, but then they change after each section.
No, they're all the same.
Probably abbreviated.
It's probably maybe just abbreviated, but they're all the same.
So it's just cut and paste, photocopy job.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And then just changing it for feelings or body.
Yep.
What's the Satipatthana Mula?
Oh, we're getting onto that in a minute.
Sorry.
Right.
Maybe we heard the part about the refrain and the 70 suttas and only that one getting used again and again and again.
Right.
And that's being emphasized.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah. Okay. And even the translation of Satipatthana in this particular version is ita, which means
mind.
Ita, still the steady. Yeah. So this is something like mano samatha, but it's obviously Satipatthana, but ita is often used for samatha. Okay. All right. In contrast with the rigid consistency of the Theravadins. Okay, it's a wobbly wobbly text. It's got all kinds of problems with the translation. It's not consistent, and then it makes all these mistakes and things like that. But that's the basic thing. So finally, we come round to the Satipatthana Sutta. So, as you can see, again, you can just see when we're told, oh, this is the Satipatthana Sutta, how much is omitted from that? Yeah? And we've done this is just a very quick survey of the field, and we spend a long time, and we're just getting around to actually the Satipatthana Sutta, right? So, again, just to have a look comparatively, this particular one, Theravada, as I noticed, it starts out, the only one to start out with Anapanasati. Put the postures after that, parts of these ones fairly similar to the other versions, feelings and mind similar to all the others. And here in the contemplation of dhammas, rather more developed than most of them, five hindrances, five aggregates, six sense media, six ayatanas, seven enlightenment factors, four noble truths. Okay, under the contemplation of dhammas. So I've already commented on that. Now it's just worth contemplating briefly on the, I've skipped over these factors of the feeling and the mind. We notice that they're pretty similar in the different versions, but it is worth just noting what these mean in the context of the suttas. The carnal and spiritual feelings, as I just mentioned, the carnal amisa is the associated with the sensual pleasures, niramisa, spiritual feelings, and specifically is defined in the Satipatthana in the Vedana Samyutta as being the spiritual pleasant feelings is the feeling in the first three jhanas, spiritual painful feeling is the longing for liberation, and spiritual neutral feeling is the feeling in the fourth jhana. Now similarly in the contemplation of mind, now these first half of it is like, it's just like kind of ordinary kind of mind states, with or without lust, with or without anger, with or without delusion, contracted or scattered. Okay, so this is talking about, you know, contemplation of, if you like, ordinary mind. Then the last four are contemplation of mind. These words, exalted, mahagata, obviously a synonym for jhana, anuttara, okay, unsurpassed, usually used of the fourth jhana, samadhi, of course, meaning jhana, and released, vimuttang, also a word for jhana. So these last four being primarily an examination of the mind in or out of jhana. So it's like not just a jhana practice, but certainly including that. Okay, and that's very clear. And notice that both of these quite clearly imply not just jhana, but also fourth jhana. Spiritual neutral feeling is specifically defined as fourth jhana. The unsurpassed mind is specifically defined as fourth jhana. And similarly, if we take the hindrances and awakening factors as the normative or most likely historical roots of the Dhamma section, then of course the enlightenment factors, including the factors of enlightenment and so on. Of samadhi and upekkha, the final one, upekkha, sambodhanga, of course, being implying, you know, including the fourth jhana. So all of these feelings, mind and dhammas are quite clearly implying the practice of jhana. In some versions, of course, we're explicitly mentioning jhanas, that is in the Sarvasivadin version, in the Akayana version, and also in the Mahasatipatthana Sutta, which mentions the four jhanas under the four noble truths. Okay, the four jhanas are mentioned by name in those versions, but in all the versions, they're clearly implied. It's not a controversial interpretation at all. The commentary interprets these exactly the same way, and it's very clearly the sutta usage. Okay.
Right at the bottom it says rise for knowledge and independence.
Mm-hmm.
Independence hasn't happened in England.
Yeah, in a few. This is the thing which in Pali, anisito ca viharati, nacikinci loke upariyati, one abides independent and does not grasp at anything in the world. Okay, so this is just a phrase which is again in some of them, and the knowledge is Ati kayoti vapanasa satipachupatita hoti yava devanyana mataya patisati mataya. One understands this is the body, there is the body, and knowledge, and this is established only sufficient for mindfulness and knowledge, something like that. So these are frames which are in a similar form, not necessarily identical, but similar form in these kinds of things. So I've identified it as being versions of those same things. Again, in the book, I'll go into the textual relationships between these things, but no need for too much. My feeling is that perhaps the this knowledge and independence, perhaps the independent refrain, may be part of the original word. I'm not sure. Okay. One thing that we noticed also from the Pali tradition, we mentioned before the existence of the Maha Satipatthana Sutta. So it's not listed separately in this table, but with the extra passage on the Four Noble Truths. And that's included in the Digha Nikaya. Now, as it happens, we have two other versions of the Digha. One in Chinese translation, the Dharmaguptaka, so from the same school as the Shariputra Abhidharma. The other one is the recently discovered Sanskrit manuscript, which is Sarvastivada, so the same school as the Dharmaskanda and the Sarvastivada version here. So we have three versions of the Digha, the Pali, Sarvastivada and Dharmaguptaka. Neither the Dharmaguptaka or Sarvastivada has any Maha Satipatthana Sutta. Okay, so there's no version of the Satipatthana Sutta found in their Digas. And it seems to be, those two schools are quite closely related to the Pali, especially the Dharmaguptaka, very closely related to the Pali, very similar. And the fact that they don't have a version of the Maha Satipatthana Sutta suggests that that particular sutta was redacted and created, not merely edited in its final form, but actually created after the schism between the schools. Okay, and when we look at the Digha Nikaya, the collection that they're part of, the latest sections of the Digha Nikaya are actually stated in the commentary to have been written in Sri Lanka. Okay, so this is some of the verses in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta and some other things like that. And there are some verses which are very, very late and so on. And the interesting thing is, when we look at those things like the Lakhana Sutta, which is also a very late sutta, has no correlation in the Digas of the other schools and has a Majjhima version in the Sarvastivadin. This is also looks like it's a similar kind of thing, that these things have been created at the same time. So they both had a version of the Satipatthana Sutta and the Lakhana Sutta, dealing with the marks of the great man. They were padded out with a lot of extra material from the Majjhima and then moved into the Digha in the Pali. And my feeling is, I can't prove this, but if we look at Sri Lankan history, it tells us in the first couple of hundred years after the advent of Buddhism, it talks a lot about people doing their meditation and things like that. And then only with the writing down of the canon in about 20 BC does it actually mention the performance of like textual redaction and the existence of scholars and things like that. Okay, so that doesn't prove anything, but if you want to look for a peg to hang it on, if you want to say, is there a convenient date that we can say when may have the Mahasatipatthana Sutta have been created, my feeling, the date that stands out as being obvious is the time that the canon was written down in the Aluvihara, so about 20 BC. So this would date the Mahasatipatthana Sutta about 400 years after the death of the Buddha. And that would be firmly in the period, the Abhidhamma period. So what I've done then is I felt that if you go through all of this stuff, right? Now I'm sure this is how you all feel. You probably all feel brain dead. You all feel I used to know how to meditate. Now I don't know what I'm doing anymore. And you kind of life crumbles around you, and you don't know what. And so I thought, well, you know, this is the problem with all this textual deconstruction. Is of course you end up with a pile of rubble. Right? You've taken everything apart. It's very clever, isn't it? Ho, 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 look at me, I'm so clever. Here's a text that was edited 2,000 years ago, you know, on palm leaves, and me with my superior university-educated text-critical faculties am able to come along and say this bit doesn't belong here and that bit doesn't belong there. You're all wrong, okay? And feel very clever about it, okay? Because being not a particularly pleasant pastime, well, it's fun, but it's not a particularly nice thing to do to a text, is it, you know? It's a text which means something, right? So what I thought is, rather than just leave it as a pile of rubble, I thought I might try to reconstruct and actually create something which maybe resemble the original Satipatthana Sutta. It's only a suggestion, it's not definitive in any sense. And so this is what I call the Satipatthana Mula, Mula being source, okay? So this being related to derived from the in Bible studies, they talk about the Q gospel being the source gospel for Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And so this is my idea of the source. So this is giving you an idea. Maybe if everything I'm saying is right, then maybe this is what the Satipatthana Sutta originally was like. This is the path to convergence, monks and nuns, for the purification of beings, for surmounting sorrow and lamentation, for ending bodily and mental suffering, for understanding the way, for witnessing Nibbana, that is the four Satipatthanas, what for. Here a monk or a nun abides contemplating a body in the body internally, contemplating body in the body externally, body in body internally and externally, ardent, clearly comprehending and mindful, having removed desire and aversion for the world. Abides contemplating a feeling in the feeling, internally, externally. Abides contemplating mind in the mind, internally. Dhamma in the dhammas, internally and externally. And how, monks and nuns, does a monk or nun abide contemplating a body in the body? Here, a monk or nun reviews this very body up from the soles of the feet and down from the tips of the hair, bounded by skin and full of many kinds of impurities. Thus, in this body there are head hairs, body hairs, nails, teeth, skin, flesh, sinews, bones, bone marrow, kidneys, heart, liver, spleen, lungs, large intestines, small intestines, contents of the stomach, feces, bile, phlegm, pus, blood, sweat, fat, tears, grease, spit, snot, oil of the joints, and urine. Just as if there were a bag with an opening at both ends full of various sorts of grains, such as hill rice, red rice, mung beans, peas, millet, and white rice, a man with good eyes would open it up and review it thus. This is hill rice, this is red rice, these are mung beans, these are peas, this is millet, and this is white rice. In just the same way, a monk or nun reviews this body up from the soles of the feet and down from the tips of the hair. Mindfulness on the body is well established for the sake of knowledge and vision. One abides independent, not grasping at anything in the world. This is how a monk or nun abides contemplating a body in the body. And further, monks and nuns, how does a monk or nun abide contemplating a feeling in the feelings? Now here, when feeling a pleasant feeling, a monk or nun understands, I feel a pleasant feeling. When feeling an unpleasant feeling, they understand, I feel an unpleasant feeling. When feeling a neither pleasant nor unpleasant feeling, they understand, I feel a neither pleasant nor unpleasant feeling. And same with carnal and spiritual, pleasant, painful, and neutral feelings. Mindfulness on feelings is well established for the sake of knowledge and vision. One understands independent, one abides independent, not grasping at anything in the world. This is how a monk or nun abides contemplating a feeling in the feelings. And further, monks or nuns, how does a monk or nun abide contemplating a mind in the mind? Here, a monk or nun understands mind with lust is mind with lust, mind without lust is mind without lust, mind with anger, mind without anger, with and without delusion, contracted, distracted, exalted, unexalted, surpassed, unsurpassed, mind in samadhi, not in samadhi, released mind and unreleased mind. Mindfulness on the mind is well established for the sake of knowledge and vision. One abides independent, not grasping at anything in the world. That is how a monk or nun abides contemplating a mind in the mind. And further, monks or nuns, how does a monk or nun abide contemplating a dhamma in the dhammas? Here, when there's sensual desire in him, a monk or nun understands there is sensual desire in me. When there's no sensual desire in him, he understands there's no sensual desire in me. And he understands how the arising of the unarisen sensual desire comes to be, and he understands how the abandoning of the arisen sensual desire comes to be, and he understands how the non-arising in the future of the unarisen sensual desire comes to be. Okay, and similarly for anger, sloth and torpor, restlessness and remorse, and doubt. And then with the awakening factors, he understands there is the awakening factor. When there's no awakening factor, there's no awakening factor. Mindfulness, he understands how the arising of the unarisen awakening factor of mindfulness comes to be, and he understands how the fulfillment through development of the arisen enlightenment factor of mindfulness comes to be, and the same with the other factors of enlightenment. Mindfulness of dhammas is well established for the sake of knowledge and vision. One understands, one abides independent, not grasping at anything in the world. That is how a monk or nun abides contemplating a dhamma in the dhammas. This is the path leading to convergence, monks and nuns, for the purification of beings, for surmounting sorrow and lamentation, for ending bodily and mental suffering, for understanding the way, for witnessing Nibbana, that is, the four Satipatthanas. Okay? So that's the sutta. So I'm sure you're all very confused, which is good. So any other questions? So then, of course, we're like 3/4 of the way through the book now. We started about 1/4 of the way through. We've done the middle half. And then he goes on to look at some more different kinds of things and the later developments in the different traditions and so on. So if you thought that was complicated so far, then you've got all these more complicated tables with comparative studies and the different Abhidhammas and things like that. This is good. This is from the what is it, the Abhidhamma Samucha or something? Asanga. Asanga is he's the Buddha Gosa of the Yogacara school, and he's given these very nice definitions here. What is mindfulness? It is non-forgetting by the mind with regard to the object experienced. Its function is non-distraction. Okay? So that's very precise. Mindfulness is non-forgetting or non-confusion by the mind with regard to the object experienced. So this is quite subtle. The object experience means that you know, for example, if you're watching your meditation object, yeah, you're watching the breath, the mindfulness is the fact that you keep on watching the breath, yeah, because it's the experience of the object which you've already experienced, and you keep on sustaining your mindfulness on that, yeah, so not forgetting that. And so that's why its function is non-distraction, because you keep on watching that same thing which your mind is already on. And then the definition of samadhi. What is samadhi? It is one-pointedness of mind on the object to be investigated. Its function consists of giving a basis to knowledge, okay, to jnana, which is of course vipassana. So the function of samadhi is to give rise to vipassana or insight knowledge. So that's very nice definitions there from the Asanga.
So vichara factor is strongly embedded as a function of mindfulness.
I think so, yeah. Yeah, very close. Absolutely. And
but also vitaka as well. Remembering not to let loose the your concentration on the object.
Yeah.
To drift off.
Yep. Keeping it going. And this is another interesting little side thing, but in this, the Pratyutpanna Buddha Sammukhavasthita Samadhi Sutra. Do you like me to say it again, darling? It says the meaning of the sutra is the Pratyutpanna, the Buddha's, it has this thing on Saripatthana, but the Pratyutpanna is the present, Buddha's of the present, face to face, Sammukha, face to face, standing. The samadhi of standing face to face with the present Buddhas, or Buddha, right? This is what that sutra is called, Mahayana Sutra. So the idea is this whole kind of thing of meditating and then having an image of the Buddha. And so it's very interesting to see how this is actually derived from the Satipatthana practice. Okay, so further, Bhadrapala, bodhisattvas who dwell contemplating a body in the body but do not think any thoughts connected with the body, again relating to the Dantabhumi Sutta, and who dwell contemplating feeling minds, blah blah blah, don't think any thoughts connected with them, those bodhisattvas attain this samadhi. Okay, so they attain the samadhi of seeing the Buddha face to face. It is because, why is that? Because if bodhisattvas practice the Satipatthana in this way, then they do not objectify any dhammas. They do not conceptualize or think discursively. They do not see any dhammas. And that's known as unobscured cognition. Okay? It is precisely unobscured cognition that is called samadhi. So this is emphasizing the development of samadhi through...
bare awareness came?
No. It's the opposite.
So what are they? You mentioned that they're looking at the, like initially I thought Buddha and Anusati or something. Mm. Anusati,
Recollection
of the Buddha.
Yeah.
They use that as their meditation object. That was my initial thought, but then it seems that they're, because that requires a little bit of discursive thinking in the beginning.
Yeah, it does, yeah. I mean, it's obviously, again, derived from that. That's another point of connection with the early suttas. But the point here is that when it says you don't see any dhammas, okay, what it means is that you don't see the dhammas of the Sarvastivada and Abhidharma, okay? So you don't see any objectively existing realities. Okay? Any objectively existing things. Yeah. You don't see any entities that exist objectively in and of themselves, okay? So you see through those things, and then that's so in a part it's a polemic against the Sarvasivadas, and it seems to be saying that Sarvasivadas are hung up on seeing all of their individual dhammas, which they take as being real, and because they're hung up on seeing those objective things, that objectifying the dhammas, then they don't actually see the truth. So when you get the unobscured cognition, you see through that, and then you see you get the Buddha knowledge. You see immeasurable and incalculable Buddhas, and hear the true Dhamma. Okay, so you actually see the Buddhas in your meditation, and you hear the Dhamma from them. When you're hearing it, you master it. That means you remember the Dhamma which you're taught by the Buddhas. Yeah? So this is giving us a very clear hint as to where Mahayana sutras come from. Okay, this is, in fact, it's telling us quite explicitly that's where Mahayana sutras come from. You do your meditation, see the Buddha, he comes and teaches you, you remember his teachings, come out and write it down. Yeah?
Isn't that true in the Theravada case though as well? The same thing as,
seeing their Dhammas? Yeah, of course, yeah. Of course, yeah. Bodhisattvas dwell contemplating body and the body and doing so that they do not see any Dhammas whatsoever. Not seeing them, they do not conceptualize or think discursively, even though they are neither blind nor deaf. Not seeing them, they are not dependent. Being not dependent, they cultivate the path. By virtue of having cultivated the path, they have no doubts regard to Dhammas, and being without doubts, they see the Buddhas. And seeing the Buddhas, by virtue of the fact that all Dhammas are unproduced, liberation occurs. Why is that? If Bodhisattvas should adopt the perception of Dhammas, again, this meaning the Abhidhamma perceptions, that itself would then be the false view of an object of apprehension. Okay? So this is this Madhyamaka critique that the idea of objectively existing Dhammas is essentially similar to the idea of a self. That self would be the false view of existence of a self, of being a soul, a person. That would be a false view of aggregates, elements, sense media, signs, existing things, cause and conditions, and the seizing of an object of apprehension. All this being the content of the standard Abhidhamma expositions.
And somehow a Buddha image does not cease to be an object of some sort?
That's not good.
Starting to choke here on this one.
Yeah, no, don't worry about it too much. But just interesting to see in the context how it's using from the Satipatthana and then using it for its own thing. And this is the other interesting part here. It says, for example, Bhadrapala, when a monk performs a meditation on ugliness, he sees in front of him corpses that are bloated, livid, putrefied, bloody, gnawed, with the flesh peeled off, with no flesh and blood, white, shell-coloured, and become skeletons. Of course, this being, again, straight out of the Satipatthana Sutta. And those corpses have not come from anywhere, nor have they gone anywhere. They're not made by anyone, nor are they made to cease by anyone. Yet Bhadrapala, by that monk's mastery of mental focusing, he sees the skeleton lying in front of him. So this is treating charnel ground meditations not as literally go to a charnel ground, but as an imaginative exercise. You imagine them, and it's moving towards that kind of idealist view where these things don't objectively exist, but because of the way you pay attention, that they are seen. Okay? And in the same manner, Bhadrapala, in whatever quarter Tathagata's arahants, perfect Buddhas might dwell, those bodhisattvas who are supported by the Buddha and established in this samadhi concentrate their minds on that quarter in order to obtain a vision of the Buddhas. And by concentrating their minds in that quarter, they see the Tathagata's arahants and perfect Buddhas. Why is that? This obtaining of a vision of the Buddhas is a natural outcome of this samadhi. The bodhisattvas who are established in this samadhi see the Tathagatas, they appear to them through the combination and concurrence of three things. The glory of the Buddha, Anubhava, as in the Buddha Anubhavena, Dhamma Anubhavena, Sangha Anubhavena, and the application of the force of their own wholesome potentials and the power from obtaining samadhi. Okay? So the interesting thing here is how the subjective aspect of visualizing decaying corpses, of course the practice inherited from early Buddhism, is then used as a textual analogy for explaining how the Buddhas and so on appear. And so this text being kind of ambiguous as to whether those Buddhas actually exist in any sense. Okay, so it's obviously kind of tending towards an idealistic conception where, you know, you're not quite sure in what sense there might be any externally existing Buddhas. So this being, I think, an interesting example of how these teachings are taken up and used in the later texts, later traditions. So I won't go into too much, but anyway, you can have a look if you want to look at those things later on.